coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 10 of The Curious Realm. I want to thank everybody out there who has been tuning in since our good old days of Dudes and Beer, all of about 2 months ago. Just over 2 months ago, actually. It was December, first Tuesday of December that we relabeled this show. And since then, quite literally, our Facebook page size has doubled. Our Facebook group size has almost doubled. Our interaction has gone up by almost 200-300%. Downloads are up. It's fantastic to see the growth in the show since the rebrand. And quite honestly, folks, that is all thanks to you guys. So thank you for always tuning in. A big, big shout out to the whole audience. Our show tonight, I am so, so excited for. We have been talking with Craig Woolheater, who is the founder of Crypto Mundo. He is also the founder of what will soon be the Texas Bigfoot Museum. He hosts the Folk Monster Festival, the Texas Bigfoot Film Festival, Texas Bigfoot Research, all kinds of good stuff. We'll be talking with Craig in the first part of the show here about cryptids in Texas, cryptids all over the place, as well as Bigfoot here in Texas and the amazing events that he puts on. We will also, in the second part of the episode, be joined. We were supposed to be joined originally by Dr. John Hall, our good friend. However, Dr. John Hall is sick. His daughter got sick and passed it on to him, and it was apparently one of those things that, like, you catch as a kid and it's gone in 24 hours, but boy, howdy, he never caught it as a kid, and it is wreaking havoc on him. So get well out there, Dr. Hall. You know that we all need you. And on his stand-in this evening is the stalwart Mike Turber from 5x5 News. We will be discussing so many points of technology that might just explain the UAP videos that are out there. The Nimitz, GoFast, Gimbal, those and more, so much more, that we will be getting into in the second part of the episode after our commercial break. Before we bring Craig Woolheater on, let's stop on by the Facebook group for Curious Realm and check out the news of the week real quick. Out of ABC News, parents of alleged school shooter have hearing to decide if they will face trial. In addition to that, Neil Young urges Spotify workers to quit their job before the company, quote, eats up your soul, end quote, and says CEO Daniel Elk is your big problem, not Joe Rogan. That is from Business Insider. I guess that Neil has forgotten that he sold his 50% of his rights to a conglomerate, which has the former head of Pfizer as its head advisor. So, out of KXAN, UT professor creates possible cedar fever cure in a martini glass. That's right, folks. An amazing gin cocktail could possibly help out with your cedar fever if you were one of those sufferers like my wife. Out of Smithsonian Mag, researchers now know where the ancient Maya planted their sacred cacao groves. And this was an interesting article out of Cell.com. A conserved role for serotoninergic neurotransmission in mediating social behavior in octopus. Now, that's a mouthful, folks, but when you go through and read it, basically what it is octopi that they put, which, you know, they've come to realize are incredibly intelligent for cephalopods, and they put them on MDMA. And the results of this study are absolutely wild. It's really interesting. Go out, check it out. That is from Cell.com. Once again, folks, stop on by, check that out. That is all the stuff from the Curious Realm group. So much more there. Come by and join the conversation. While you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by the Curious Realm store, curiousrealm.com/store. That's where you can get all the awesome merch, handbags, tote bags, notebooks, masks, tie-dye shirts. You can even get all of the books from our guests. So much great stuff there at the Curious Realm shop. Even if you go down to the bottom, you'll see all kinds of scientific equipment for, you know, testing out in the field, things like that, Geiger counters, thermal imaging devices, all kinds of wild stuff. Stop on by, check it out. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you want to go. And while you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by CryptoMundo.com. CryptoMundo.com is, of course, one of the first efforts put out by our guest, Craig Woolheater. This is how I first came to know about Craig, was many, many years ago, hearing him on radio shows talking about CryptoMundo and cryptids, things like that. Welcome. Well, welcome to the newly branded show, Craig Woolheater. You are much like many of our others, a previous guest, but welcome back. How have you been doing?
I've been doing good, dudes, with no beer.
That's right. That's right. We can drink scotch on air now if we wanted to. And
oh,
not,
man, y'all
not disappoint
tight.
Anybody. But
speaking of octopi, it seems like I saw a recent news story that talked about that the consensus of I think scientists was that octopi were not of this world. Did you see that story a while back?
Yeah. I have been following that, and every once in a while there is some hubbub that goes on about it. And yeah, there it is from Trending Science. Here's Cordis.eu, Trending Science. Do octopi come from outer space? And yeah, really, really interesting studies into their DNA and the source of it and the mutagenesis of it. Just really wild stuff. Very interesting because for something that's supposed to be basically like a mollusk without a shell, like a slug or a snail almost.
Right.
They are incredibly intelligent. Incredibly intelligent.
And you know what? I think that's another case of the Simpsons predicting the future. Remember?
Yeah.
They had the space alien guys that looked very much like octopi.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Kang and Kodos. They on the constant quest to take over the world. I keep saying, keep trashing the oceans and the Simpsons will be right again. The dolphins will come and take over.
That's right.
But
I wouldn't be surprised. We'll start having, dolphin man.
Yeah.
Sightings.
Let's go ahead and get into things, because not a lot of people might be familiar with not only the topic of cryptozoology, Craig, but your involvement in the field and your involvement in research when it comes to Bigfoot, especially here in Texas, other cryptids, and chronicling these things across the country and across the globe.
Well, I had an experience. Even going farther back than that, I was interested as a young kid in. I certainly didn't know it as cryptozoology back then, but the first thing that really got me interested was, I grew up in the DFW area, lived there my whole life until just recently, but the curious case of the Lake Worth Monster in the summer of 1969 was, it was called a goat man, but I think that it was just a Bigfoot, a light-colored albino or white or gray Bigfoot that, hung around that area, especially that summer. I mean, it was seen by hundreds of people at what used to be, just like a place where the kids went parking, and made out and you know, drink beer or whatever. And it's now basically a city park owned by the city of Fort Worth. It's a nature center and refuge. And they host well, it's not annual anymore, but every 5 years, a Lake Worth Monster Bash there that celebrates the, you know, the history and the story of the Lake Worth Monster, which is pretty cool. I help out with the city of Fort Worth. They actually came to me wanting to put this on for the 40th anniversary, which was in 2009.
Oh, wow.
And held it 2009, 10, and 11. Then they decided to do it every 5 years. So then it was 14 and 19. So in, you know, 2.5 years, it'll be time for it again in 2024. But that's what started my interest, was the story of that. It was on the front page of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the local newspaper, on July 10th and July 11th, which, you know, is only 9 and 10 days before we landed on the moon for the first time. And the front page story on the newspaper was about this hairy monster that was out at the lake. And, you know, we're counting down to blasting off to the moon. And that was, you know, capturing people's interest. And then I read a couple more books as a kid. And then, you know, the Legend of Boggy Creek, about true life events that happened in Falk, Arkansas and surrounding areas, that came out in 72, but it was 73 before it had national distribution. So I saw it in 73. And so that, you know, really got me interested in the subjects. But in 1994, Memorial Day, 1994, May 30th, I was coming back from going with friends to New Orleans. You know, this is before Google Maps, before GPS, before MapQuest, before any of that stuff. So you just laid out, you know, a road atlas and plotted your course, what looked like, you know, what was shortest. And that's what we did. We left Dallas at about 5:30 in the morning on a Friday morning. And by the time we were in central Louisiana, it was, you know, it was mid-morning. So it wasn't, you know, really anything. And then when we left, there was 12 people that actually went in 5 different cars. So we caravaned down there. But on Monday, when it was time to go home, people left at different times. And my vehicle was the last one to leave at about 9 o'clock Monday night on Memorial Day. And so my girlfriend was riding with me, and a friend who lived in the same building that I did rode in the back seat. She had to be at work the next morning, so she slept. And we set off from New Orleans and, you know, headed towards Dallas and, you know, round around Baton Rouge and heading towards Shreveport. And now this road that was a state highway marked as such was a 2-lane unlit road out in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, we're just trucking along and, you know, it's very, very, very dark out there. It's about 11:30 at night now. And, my girlfriend and I, see an upright figure off to the right of the road. On one side, it's real swampy. And on the other side, there's a tree line about 30 feet out. And we see an upright figure on two legs covered with hair. It looked to be gray in the headlights, you know, walking parallel to the road about 20 feet off the road. And, you know, in my headlights, we saw it, you know, maybe 7 or 8 seconds until we passed it. But as soon as we passed it, we said, you know, we looked at each other and said, "Did you just see what I just saw?" And we agreed that we had. And I was like, "Well, what do you think you saw?" And she goes, "Well, I think I saw a Bigfoot." I was like, "Well, we got to stop." And she used a few choice words, but basically did not want to stop. So we didn't. We drove a little bit through, then entered a small town called Bunky, Louisiana.
Yep.
And there was nothing. It was 11:30 at night. The sidewalks were rolled up. nothing open, no nothing. So we drove through town, and on the way out of town, saw a small church off to the right. We pulled in the parking lot there to talk about what we had seen. Just, you know, no more than 10 or 15 minutes did we talk about it. My friend had to be at work that next morning, so we were still, you know, 5.5 hours, 6 hours from Dallas. So we got back on the road and didn't even really talk about it. We just drove. It was just something weird that happened. When we got home, we didn't talk about it. I mean, some of your viewers are probably younger than I am. I'll probably think it was weird, but you know, this is on May 30th, 1994. And I was still 3 years from getting on the internet. So, yeah. You know, when I did get on the internet, you know, in summer of 97, you know, that's one of the first things I looked up was Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And saw, you know, certainly not near the information that's out there on the internet now, but you know, there were mainly message boards and forums and such with people talking. And so I went on there and shared my story and, you know, met people and, you know, met a gentleman that, you know, wanted to start up a research group. And so we did. I mean, I wasn't an outdoorsman or a hunter or anything, but I just wanted to try and find answers to what I had encountered. And so we started up the Texas Bigfoot Research Center, and coming up will be, it was in 99. So what, it's going to be the 23rd anniversary soon. So we put up a cheesy website, you know, a free Angel Fire website with blinking animations and stupid stuff. But, you know, people came to it and you know, started reporting things that they had seen or encountered and wanting to get involved with what we were doing. So, you know, that's how it really took off. And in April of 2000, we went up to Ohio to the Ohio Bigfoot Conference and networked with people up there. And I saw, you know, that they were doing this conference. And I was like, well, you know, there's nothing like this in Texas. I bet I could pull this off. And so when I went to pick places, Jefferson just stood out. My folks had been living there for a couple years and had bought a bed and breakfast, and my mom was on the events committee for the Bed and Breakfast Association, and there was a history of sightings in the area and Caddo Lake and everything. So we started it up there. The first one was September 15th, 2001, which was unfortunately only 4 days after 9/11. But we still had over 130 people that showed up that Saturday. You know, we just took off from there and kept promoting. And we were courted by different cities, Athens and Tyler, Texas, both courted us, wanted us to bring it there. And after the 2008 conference, because we, you know, we brought a lot of people to town, a tourist town there. And by then we had rebranded as a nonprofit 501c3, and everything wasn't, you know, really up to me anymore. It was all done by committee. And so I got, Tyler got picked to go to Tyler. And did it there 3 years. And then I decided I needed to focus on other things. So I dropped out of the organization, but my interest did not drop out or anything. And the organization skipped a year and then moved it to Fort Worth at the Tarrant County Convention Center and still, you know, didn't draw any more people. So they kind of gave up on the event as an annual fundraiser. So I decided in 2014 to take it back to Jefferson as the original Texas Bigfoot Conference, originally organized by me, originally in Jefferson there. And so we started it back up in 2014. In 2018, Jefferson, the mayor signed a town proclamation proclaiming Jefferson as the Bigfoot capital of Texas. you know, we've had all kinds of different people speak there, from Bob Giblin to Lauren Coleman, Jeff Meldrum, yeah, you know, just a long list of people, John Bendernagel before he passed away. You know, we've had tons and tons of people that have showed up to speak, and you know, my folks always wanted me to move to Jefferson, but I couldn't because of work. But I've since retired and only organizing events and such. And so I decided when I was planning to move and not knowing where I was going to move to, I was like, well, yeah, what about Jefferson? You know, because if not now, when, you know, it just made sense to me. And when I thought about it, my events are there. You know, I've been wanting to open up a Bigfoot museum for years and years, and always lived hundreds of miles away. So I've moved there as of January 1st. I'm actively seeking a location to put in the Texas Bigfoot Museum, and got people willing to help out with artifacts and such, and helping to design the museum and plan the floor space and all that. So I'm working on that.
Yeah, and I love the fact that you were opening up a museum. Sadly, right as I moved from Portland, Maine, 6 months later, Lauren Coleman opened the Cryptozoology Museum. I remember every once in a while, I would see his little Bigfoot mobile, his with the crypto license plate rolling down the road, and it was like, I would hear him all the time on Coast to Coast talking about how he lived there, and it was like, man, I am keeping my eye out. I'm looking for him, and I would see his car putting around every once in a while, and yeah, I was so excited.
He's actually moving to Bangor, Maine. The process of, and he's opening up a cryptozoology bookstore there, an annex. Great. Of the museum in Bangor.
Oh, that's awesome, man. And I mean, there are a few people in the world of mysterious strange that live up there, like Freddie Silva, who is a fantastic researcher into ancient civilizations, portals, things like that. He's based up there in Maine. There's a few folk like that.
Well, Maine, you know, is all kinds of cool, weird stuff up there, you know, the you know, on the way, you know, you have the where all the witches were hanged there, you know, on the way to Portland from Boston.
Yeah.
And
Salem, you know, is just right there off Route 1.
Salem is really creepy.
I love that. Is probably, and I travel the country pretty regularly for work. At one point I was going out for like 40 weeks a year for work, but Salem to this day is hands down one of my favorite towns in this country, man. It's something about it. Like, even though it's got this wicked, creepy history and, you know, things that are just really not like pleasant in their history, you know, like Texas has some stuff that's pretty not pleasant too, but we didn't necessarily just like, we didn't do that. We didn't like crush people under rocks.
Young girls, because they were accused of being a witch.
You know, that's one of my jokes all the time about redheads is, hey, you know, we were burned as witches for years. You wonder why we don't like talking to people. Like, we were driven from towns and drowned in Sax's children, all kinds of stuff. But it's interesting because Maine is one of those places that, much like Texas, has numerous reports of cryptids, things like that. There was one just not too long ago up in the Maine area. But let's start getting into some of the cryptid cases here in Texas and some of the things that led to the creation of the Bigfoot Research Center. Because, of course, like you said, you had your own experience that kind of led to that, but...
Right.
But since then, how has meeting other people and networking with other people, especially since the beginning of the internet and founding Cryptomundo, like Cryptomundo is how I found out about cryptozoology.
Yeah, that went live on, I believe it was September 26th or 27th, 2005. So, I mean, That's ancient. That's, you know, back in the early days of blogging, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, of real internet. That's when, like, the internet became what it is now. You know, not necessarily like it was whenever you had your sighting and you had to go out and join a bulletin board and a discussion group and all that kind of stuff. This was like, hey, here's my page. Go check it out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people used to submit all kinds of weird shit to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, weird creature sightings, weird, you know, one of the most popular things was a weird postcard that Lauren had come across with some weird fish that looked like it was in, you know, on land at a with palm trees, a hut looked like in the South Pacific, and, you know, submitting guess after guess after guess to guess what the mystery fish was. I mean,
yeah,
we got plenty of wild stories of, it ended up getting, covered on, I'm trying to think. One of the series that was on Monster Quest. I can't believe Monster Quest that was on the
history. Yeah, yeah. There you go.
About some kind of weird prehistoric seal with a trident shaped.
Yeah.
Tail. I mean, that was featured, ended up on Monster Quest, but it first was on Cryptomundo. The guy sent, you know, a drawing, you know, he sent a CD with photographs and videos and, you know, we posted that, you know, way back when, and it ended up being on a episode of Monster Quest. There was an awesome report that we investigated here out in East Texas with the, you know, it became known as the Hog Hunter report that a guy that was out hog hunting, you know, was up in a tree stand and there was some hogs around and he heard some weird sounds and, you know, he claimed that, you know, he saw a Bigfoot in it, that it was actually like leaping between trees and ended up, you know, basically putting a hog in a headlock and slamming it against a tree until he killed it and then threw it up over its shoulder. And he was freaked out, you know, in a tree stand. And as the thing walks off, it looked up over its shoulder and looked right at him and let out, he said, this ungodly howl. And not only that, but, you know, from behind him, he heard a similar vocalization from something that was apparently answering it. And, he was really, really, really in fear for his life. We had another guy. This was a bow hunter that was up in a tree stand up near Falk, Arkansas, that was there early in the morning. And he was, you know, concealed wearing all black. And, you know, as the sun started coming out, he saw what looked like a cow coming up under his tree stand. And pretty soon the cow stood up, being that it wasn't a cow, but it was actually a Bigfoot, and was, you know, fairly up close to him by the time it stood up, that it actually reached up and touched the broadhead on his arrow, and it was so sharp it cut its finger, and he said that it just screamed basically in his face, you know, close, just a couple of feet away, and you know, freaked him out. But, you know, I've, you know, out there where I'm living now near Jefferson, I've investigated several road crossing reports of people, you know, seeing one cross the road in front of or behind their car. Plenty of hunters that have seen them out there when they're hunting. And, you know, I've had one especially that I remember telling me up on the Red River that he said that he saw what he thought was a burned out tree stump until he looked through his scope, and when he saw it through his scope, he said it was a tall ape-like creature that was standing perfectly still. And he said that it was standing in about, you know, I would say three foot tall grass weeds area. He was deer hunting, and he was set up on the bank of a creek where he had seen some deer rubs on the trees. And he looked at this thing through his scope, and he said, "I felt like I could have proved it once and for all and shot it right between the eyes." But he Wow. said he didn't know what it was. And as hunters are told, you know, identify your prey before you know what you're shooting at. Yep. And he didn't know what he was shooting at, so he didn't.
Know your target and what's beyond it.
And shortly after that, he heard a vocalization from over his left shoulder. And he said that he turned around to look and didn't see anything. And when he turned back, it was gone. He felt that it did not have time to actually run for cover in the woods. He felt that it had dropped down into the grass out of sight, which, like I said, creeped the hell out of him. And he just left everything there and ran to his vehicle and left.
Wow.
Left his, you know, his gear, everything there. You know, so, you know, I don't know. Do you do a break halfway through, or we just
Well,
talk?
I mean, we do a break after our first guest. So whenever you and I are done, we'll okay. have a break and then our pre-recorded guest. But okay. yeah.
Well, then I'll just keep on going.
Oh, absolutely. Cause this is interesting to me, because I just had the conversation with, Dr. John Hall had actively right. invited me to go out on a pig hunt,
cool.
at his ranch. Oh, it was super fun. It was great. We got there. He actually had a Bigfoot painted on the door of his cabin. It was awesome.
Oh, that's way.
And so that began the conversation as we were setting up camp and the campfire of, you know, any sightings in the area. And it was up around Bandera, you know, stuff like that. I was like, I'd Google, but we lost signal as we came onto the property. So,
The sightings down there are pretty few and far between.
Yeah. But
they're mostly in the eastern one third of the state, which is
the big
heavily
thicket forested area,
the big thicket, yeah. the piney woods, you know, with plenty of rainfall. I mean, yeah. veteran researcher John Green came up with, you know, his theory was that, you know, the majority of sightings are in areas that have over 20 inches of annual rainfall. Mm. And Far East Texas is, you know, like between 50 and 60 inches.
That makes a lot of sense.
You have to have three things for, you know, basically for animals, wild animals. You have to have ample food source, you have to have ample water, and you have to have cover. So when you're out there, you know, in West Texas, you know, there are riparian areas where rivers, you know, come through, and, you know, vegetation is lush, you know, right there, you know, basically the riverbanks. But, you know, it's, you know, other than right there where there is wildlife, there's water, there's, you know, food sources.
Yeah.
You know, and they may travel those routes, you know, the Colorado River, whatever out there, but they, you know, apparently from reports, you know, sighting reports that we get, there's not a lot of things seen, but, you know, you have to have two things for a Bigfoot sighting report. Not only do you have to have the Bigfoot there, but you actually have to have a person there to see it, to report it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess the same thing as, you know, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody's here to hear it, does it make a sound?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a Bigfoot out there, but there's nobody to see it, then there's not going to be a reported sighting. And you know, reported sightings are generally just a you know, just a sliver of time in that creature's activities for the day. So, you know, for people to say they do this and they do that, you know, because they had a split second sighting, you know, 8, 10, 20 seconds. I mean, that's such a small sliver out of that whole 24-hour period of what that animal may have been doing, you know, foraging for food know, whatever it may be doing. So it's, you know, like I said, I've had to have talked to over 300 people over the years, telling me that they had seen one of these, they found tracks, you know, had seen, you know, one or even more of these. I mean, it's rare, but, you know, people do report seeing, you know, groups of them, which, you know, only makes sense. You know, it's obviously not the one Bigfoot wandering the whole country. I mean, it's, you know, it's got to be a, you know, a population of them that, you know, can breed, sustain a population of them. You know, it may not be, you know, that many of them. And, you know, veteran researchers have estimated, you know, is, you know, maybe 2,000 to 6,000 of them in North America. So, you know, that's spread out over, you know, that may be, you know, 100 in the whole state of Texas, maybe, you know, I don't know. I mean, and people say, well, you know, why don't we get them on game cameras? There's all these game, you know, trail cameras out there. And it's like, you know, in the, I'm trying to remember the exact, in the 4-state region of Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana, there is, do you know what's bigger, a square mile or a square acre? Do you happen to know?
Square acre, if I'm not mistaken. Or no, square mile. Square mile, because 40 acres is a quarter mile by quarter mile.
Okay. So, and that, they get you your 40 acres and a mule.
That's it.
There's the last, when I looked up the statistics, there is in the 4-state region, and most of it is where the 4 states come together.
Come together. Once again, that big thicket region.
Big thicket, the Piney Woods, southeast Oklahoma.
Yep.
Southwest Arkansas, northwest Louisiana.
Yeah.
100,000 square miles, which is 66,000 square acres of timberland in those four. That's more than in the, you know, the whole state of Oregon, more than the size of the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
Timberland. And, you know, when you figure out how many trail cameras are out there versus how many Bigfoots are walking around out in these woods. I mean, it's, I've likened it not to looking for a needle in a haystack, but looking for a moving needle in a whole field of hay.
Yeah.
That it's,
and you don't
it's,
know what a magnet is.
Yeah. And we'll just take, for instance, I think the last count was 72 aircraft in the Pacific Northwest that have crashed
and not been found.
And those are stationary objects made out of metal
that have a transponder.
Yeah. That haven't been found.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that last time we had you on, one of the points that I make, one of the points I make to people all the time is if you're a hunter, outdoorsman, if you spend any kind of time outside, you know, gone out on like horn hunts, stuff like that, where you're just looking for shedded horns, stuff like that after buck season, you know, after the rut, that kind of stuff. You're hard pressed to find a full skeleton of a black bear.
Oh, yeah.
You're hard pressed to find a full skeleton of any large game. Because predators take it, drag it off. Heck, man, let a rut of pigs come by, you know?
Yeah.
If a rut of pigs come by, like, hey, you can feed people the pigs. They don't care. Yeah. They will eat it. And one of the other points go ahead.
I said to the bone and then the bones.
Yeah. And then the bones. Yeah. And then the bones. Exactly. And one of the other points I make, and granted, this picture I'm about to show is from 2012. But this is a picture from NASA, from the ISS. And when you're talking specifically about the Four Corners area that you were just talking about of Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, check out this map right here. So here is from NASA, folks, just so you know, I'm not like pulling up an image randomly from like, you know, 1982 or something. This is from 2012, December 5th, 2012. This is officially what the U.S. looked like at night from the ISS. Now, look at that area right there that he's talking about. And look at all that black. That is all the area that people do not live.
Yeah, people think, you know,
look
that
at all
here,
that. We're Bigfoot sighted more than anywhere else. Take a look at that.
People,
and that'll
think,
give you a real good idea.
Yeah, people think that the United States, that people have stepped on every inch of of land.
Yeah,
out
but it's
there.
All concrete, like Houston.
Yeah, and you know, there is plenty of, I'm sure there's plenty of unexplored territory that a person has never walked on.
Look at the state of Maine. The state of Maine has more coastline, more uninterrupted coastline than just about any state. And three quarters of the state of Maine is protected land. Three quarters of it. The King's Forest still exists, where the King of England said this forest, because of its straight pine trees, is where we will get all of the timber for the ships, for the Royal Navy, for all of our masts. They all come there. And to this day, that forest is still protected.
Yeah. I mean, there's
their main export, people, just so you know, toothpicks.
It is. It's not lobster.
Toothpicks. Toothpicks. For the persnickety lobster eater, Craig.
They must have to whittle those pine trees down pretty small.
Yeah, imagine how many you get out of one that you could make a ship mast out of.
Yeah, that's a lot of toothpicks.
That's a lot of toothpicks. So, yeah, you know, but when you start looking at those maps and you start seeing, like, Maine, another hot spot, there's a reason why Lauren Coleman lives there, folks, because it's a hot spot for these things. When you start looking at the Pacific Northwest, when you start looking up by the Great Lakes region, when you start looking down here, even California.
Yeah.
Like, it's black at night. That is all of a decade ago, Craig. All of a decade ago, that is the settlement that was going on in those areas.
So, you know, people always say, well, you know, if Bigfoot was real,
we'd see him.
Well, people do see him. I don't think more than 10%, if that many people that see him report him. I mean, you know, they don't know who to report it to.
I guarantee you, I don't care how much you hunt, Craig. And I got a lot of hardcore hunters in my family. I'm a Cajun. Like, I got family that trapped at one point in their life, you know? I don't care how much you hunt. Mathematically, you spend more time in the bathroom during your life than you do out on hunting.
Sure.
The average person. So, yeah, even the average hunter, you will spend more time in the bathroom on the toilet scrolling through Facebook than you will out in the field with a rifle in your hand or a scope in your hand looking down range. So, just observationally, the odds are against us.
Sure. Like I said, you know, there has to be a Bigfoot there and there has to be a person to see it.
Yeah. Now, a few years back, and this is quite a number of years back, right up around the same time that you launched Crypto Mundo, there was a gentleman here in Texas, just right here in the hill country between Austin and San Antonio, that was putting on, quote, Bigfoot hunts. I don't know if you remember that, where his goal was to stalk Bigfoot with people, where it was like, this is like a big game hunt.
Wow. That
you could go on. And there is even a cadre of folks here in Texas. I know that they were on I want to say that they were either, it was a documentary done about them.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been trying to get them on the show because I think that it's an interesting concept that the only way science as we know it is going to accept it is with a body.
Sure.
What do you make of that? As somebody who has been in the field, at least since the field became the field that we know today, I'm not going to say that cryptozoology did not. That's like saying that ufology didn't exist before the internet existed. You're damn right it did, folks. And it was huge and it was strong. And so was cryptozoology amongst the people like Lauren Coleman, folks like that, Nick Redfern's, those folks. They were down deep in the thick of things years and years and years ago. And as were you, and that's just it. To know what it's become now, the sensationalism,
right,
as opposed to the hard hunt for fact.
Well, you know, I know that I did a series of, it was, three nights that we did on a TV state news station in Tyler, that they did a three-part series on us and you know, talked to other people and, you know, Texas Parks and Wildlife and wildlife biology. And, you know, so I actually contacted the gentleman who was in charge. His name at the time was Dwayne Schlitter. He's retired. I don't even know if he's still alive, but he had conveyed to me that what we were doing at the time, which was a 5-year-long camera trap study, we actually worked with governmental agencies. We had worked under the permission of the Nature Conservancy in Southeast Oklahoma. Yep. We were working with Texas Parks and Wildlife we had hare snares up in Southeast Oklahoma that we never got what was suspected a Bigfoot hare, but we got lots of black bear hare.
Yeah.
And they had contacted us and wanted us to send them their black bear hare so they could see, you know, do DNA studies to see where the bears were coming from back into East Texas. Whether they were wanting to eliminate, you know, were they coming in from Southeast Oklahoma because that's where we had our hare snares, or, you know, coming over from Louisiana or what. But we actually had permits from the National Park Service to operate long-term camera studies in the Big Thicket, which is governed by the National Park Service, for a camera trap study looking for Bigfoot. And we actually had permits from the National Park Service to allow us to put our cameras out there. The only thing is we had to issue a report at the end of the year, at the end of the fiscal year, and include a copy of every photograph of wildlife that we captured.
Yeah.
And
give them rights to use it, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, but the camera study was not for wildlife camera study. It was for Bigfoot.
We were
issued permits. We used the Big Thicket Research Stations as an authorized scientific research organization that we would, you know, have a week-long stint at the research organization, research centers, laboratories, and such. In the Big Thicket, we actually had permission from the U.S. Forest Service to have camera studies in Sam Houston National Forest.
Oh, so, wow. I mean,
these were governmental.
Right down the road.
These were governmental agencies that gave us permission to gather photographic evidence of Bigfoot, because Dwayne Schlitter, the guy who was in charge of the rare and endangered wildlife for Texas Parks and Wildlife, told me, issued a statement that with photographic or video evidence that they could determine that was not tampered with, could be used to determine that these were an actual species. So that's why we had the long-term camera trap project, because we were told that if we could capture, you know,
anything.
images, video images that was not tampered with, yeah. that was still, you know, on the memory card in the camera, that we had a chain of command when we collected these, you know, and went through them. You know, we were working to provide that evidence to Texas Parks and Wildlife. And unfortunately, we never got it. But once again, you know, you're looking at, you know, very yeah. scarce coverage of what I think would be these Bigfoot creatures out there versus how many cameras you had. We had like 40, you know, these were high dollar cameras that we had. Yeah, yeah, there yeah. were like 650 of them, and we had like 40 of them.
Yep.
You actually, Baylor University had sponsored us and bought us some of those cameras.
Oh, wow.
Two professors at Baylor University used university funding to purchase us equipment for this study.
Incredible.
So, I mean, you know, we weren't just some rinky dink.
Well, even beside that, one question that I would have for you real quick, Craig, is amongst the traps that you were able to get, especially saying that, you know, in Oklahoma specifically, you got a lot of black bear hair, things like that.
Yeah.
Out of the number of traps you had, how many did you have black bear on? Because once again, that in and of itself is a telling sign whenever you're talking about this is a known black bear territory. Out of like 25 traps we had set, we only got samples out of two or three, you know?
Well, we didn't get hair samples that often, but we did catch them on our cameras. And we found out that the bears were attracted to the plastic of the cameras.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, we had bears that, you know, tore open cameras off of trees. We had a box that I had a video. We had a video camera mounted in that was to trip it. And we got we also had camera traps that were watching each other. And we got footage of a bear disassembling that video camera, ripping that box off the tree and tearing the camera out of it.
And so we had if you look at it, a trail camera looks almost exactly like what you would use to trap a bee swarm.
Right.
Except in smaller form. So it makes total sense that a bear would be like, let's get up in that thing. If they see it, they will try to get in it. That is most definite.
So we had to have these heavy steel boxes made that they couldn't break into. The cameras were safe inside. Now they could, you know, we chained them, you know, chained steel plate boxes that were welded to trees to, you know, to keep them intact. But, you know, we actually found a bear track in a rotted log that was on the ground down in the big thicket that, it was a bear track. And we, you know, got documented that and gave it to Texas Parks and Wildlife because, you know, they were getting reports of bears coming back into East Texas, repopulating East Texas. And they were, like I said, trying to find out where they were coming from.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just it. You know, if anything, why the efficacy of the footage that you gather, the data that you're able to gather, It's amazing to be able to provide to someone like Texas Parks and Wildlife. And there's a reason why a university will help fund it because, yeah, they can use that same thing to help out with all kinds of stuff within departments, to help fund studies of their own to say, hey, we can show that there are no less than, you know, 10 black bear sightings per day in this region. We really need to go study it. Give us a grant to do it. You know, and that's totally worthwhile of, you know, $5 or $6 or $10 $200 trail cameras and a group of 5 or 10 volunteers that are willing to go out and spend their own time doing it.
Yeah.
That's literally immediately like a fifth the size of any grant that you would apply for.
Right. So, I mean, you know, we were a recognized, you know, scientific research organization that, you know, was, like I said, to me, the fact that the National Park Service issued us permits
to hunt for Bigfoot,
to look for, to get photographic or video evidence of Bigfoot. I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty impressive, you know, even if it wasn't my organization that was, you know, was great. Permit. I mean, for somebody to, you know, for the National Park Service to issue a permit to try and get pictures of Bigfoot. I mean, that's pretty impressive that, because they had to have somebody to monitor that program to, you know, go through the report when we sent it in and, you know, examine all the pictures. I mean, you know, that's somebody that's on the government's dime to do that.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because there are places like Washington State, I popped it up on screen a while ago, where, yeah, state parks actively have, like, Bigfoot warning signs, things like that. Like, it is an accepted part of this may be a species that's out here that, you know, much like, hey, just so you know, there's a bear, you probably won't see a bear.
Right.
You probably won't come across a mountain lion, but you might.
Right.
And if you do, it might be dangerous because, like, one out of every 30 encounters with a mountain lion is dangerous. And sadly, one out of 30 out of every 150 times somebody's aware that there's a mountain lion there.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, you're just being stalked by a mountain lion because you're in its range. You're in its home range, and it's curious about you, and, you know, not really hungry. I'd prefer a rabbit because it's more of a light snack than a meal. But
I saw a video. I don't know if you saw this video. It was a guy, I think, out in California that did not know it but was being stalked by a mountain lion. He was hiking, and he just happened to turn around at the time that this thing was charging him from, like, 20 feet away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And that's just it, you know. And now, in your experience and in the stories you've gathered, the things that you've gathered that will be going into the Texas Bigfoot Museum, Craig, are the great majority of these passive events? Are the great majority of these, I saw something in the distance? Or is there a decent majority that are, I had an interaction?
Most of them are going to be, from a distance. Mm. You know, have road crossings, like people I've talked to that, you know, are my,
experience. Yeah.
Dismissed every person I talked to that told me of their encounter, you know, I still have my own that I can't dismiss. I mean, you know, it obviously wasn't a burned out tree stump. It was walking, moving.
It wasn't
a horse or a cow or, you know, a bipedal bear or, you know, a hunter in a ghillie suit or some prankster in a ape costume.
A passing car through trees or.
Yeah, there were no cars. Yeah. There was, you know, no street lights. There were no nothing out there that night. I personally don't. This stretch of two-lane highway, state highway, I don't recall passing a car on it.
I can't imagine that you would. My family is from Mamou, Louisiana, right down the road from where you're. And there ain't, even to this day, my friend, there ain't much where you're talking about.
Yeah, there's not.
come nighttime, the sidewalks are rolled up if you're passing through downtown.
That 11:30 at night through that small town of Bunky, the sidewalks were rolled up, all the lights were out, and there was nothing there. But I guess we're about to run out of time. So,
if you have more time, feel free to stay. There is no time limit to your time here, Craig. So, I mean, it's up to you whenever you want to leave, if you need to go.
Okay.
We can do that.
Well, we can discuss, you know, stuff that I've got coming up.
I definitely want to, because that's always the last part of the show with any guest, is the shameless self-promotion for the last few minutes. So yeah. I definitely want to get into that. But, it's interesting to me, the number of people who completely disavow any possibility of Bigfoot or Sasquatch or Yeti or Wildman or Yowie or whatever you want to call them, world over, folks. I think that's probably one of the biggest issues I have, is the fact of we have anecdotal evidence from cultures the world over, from just about the time that civilization began, at least the civilizations and the cultures that we know. And these are cultures like the Aborigines in Australia, and even the Native Americans here in America, where like their culture is unchanged and passed down orally.
Yep. Centuries of folklore and traditions of, you know, the hairy man of the woods,
yeah,
who was to them another tribe. And you know, I got a quote here that I
please
just 6 days ago, and it's a quote by Dr. Wayne Dyer. It's the highest form of ignorance is when you reject something you don't know anything about.
Exactly. And that is one of the things that we bring up regularly on this show, Craig, is the fact of I am no science denier. I am a science freak. My son knows every single planet, and I'm disappointed there's no Pluto for him. But he knows about it. He knows about it. And he knows that it's not on his chart of planets that's new. But he knows that Pluto's there and that it's a thing. And that's the thing, is that my whole life, like I have a book, like the actual teacher's edition of the astronomy book I was taught from in high school, because when I graduated was the last year that astronomy happened. I took it my junior year, but my teacher, we developed a relationship. I would go out to morning labs and she would bring the telescope. It was great. And she gave me her teacher's edition
of our
book. And funny thing, man, Pluto's in there. It's a planet. If you think that science is static in any way, shape, or form, you are the problem, people. I love you in all agape sense of the word of brotherly love. I love you.
Thank you, sir.
But this is anybody. This is anybody, Craig. The fact of, but if you can't accept the fact that science changes, science is not static. The point of science is to question itself and to question the hypothesis. You're allowed to hypothesize anything. Through theory and experimentation, the hypothesis is proven or disproven.
Remind me, send me a message to, send you a story that came out of Discover magazine in 1999 that talks about how arrogant science and scientists are.
Oh, we talk regularly on this show about the literal religion of science. And hey, my freshman year of college was spent as a seminarian at University of Dallas in Irving, Texas. For the Roman Catholic Church, like I know what dogma and doctrine is, and you cannot tell me that it's any damn different. Any different. And it's sad, and it's kind of horrifying because, these people who I think it's like the East Texas Bigfoot Coalition or something that are like, we will hunt a Bigfoot. If it takes us putting a Bigfoot on a slab and bringing it to you, that's what we'll do. And I guess that's my question, is that what we should be trying to do, Craig? Is that what we should be trying to encourage? I don't want to discourage this concept, but at the same time, it's one of those, like, you know, we put out X prizes. You know what I mean? For like, what civilian company can launch something this big into space first? You know, when will we have the true X prize for things like this?
You know, I don't know. I mean, there was, it's been some years back, you know, maybe 15 years ago, but there was a new species of monkey that was described purely by photographic evidence. It was not described by having, you know, a specimen to examine. Now, granted, that's, you know, monkeys are, you know, known. Something like Bigfoot, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that you could, a specimen could be collected, you know, a natural death or, you know, a roadkill or something perhaps, and not, you know, actually have to take a specimen. I mean, you know, nobody knows for sure how many of them there are. I mean,
sure. You know, there could be like 15 of these things worldwide. Who knows?
I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, there may be, thoughts are, general consensus thoughts are that they, you know, that they have a family group, you know, just like most primates, you know, you have a male, you have several females and young males anyway, that, you know, after they grow up, wander off and start their own group. But I mean, what if you, decimated the, a female, and took that out of the breeding population. I mean, you may have doomed that tribe of them or whatever you want to call them to extinction. I mean, you know, who knows how many there is there's got to be a better way, in my opinion. Now, granted, the easiest way would be with a carcass or even part of a carcass. You know, if you had, somebody shot one and, you know, decapitated and took a hand and a head or a head and a foot or whatever, and, you know, could have it examined.
Yeah.
But I'd hate to think that, you know, I've stood against that, for years and years and years that, you know, I would not, you know, harm a live species to take it in to be examined. I mean, you know, or even, you know, I'd hate to see one end up in a zoo. I mean, it's sad, zoo animals. I mean, there's just that case just happened like last week, I think, because I know I posted it on my Facebook wall again.
Mm, yeah.
So I forget what country, with a tiger, a guy jumped over the fence, the outside fence, got to the inside fence and stuck his hand in there, and the tiger grabbed his hand and basically ripped his hand off, and they had to kill the tiger to get it to let go of the guy, and they weren't even going to press any charges on him. So this rare and endangered and beautiful animal is now dead.
Yeah,
because this jackass stuck his hand in the cage.
Yep.
What do you think is going to happen?
Hey, brother, I don't know if you remember the story out of Houston, probably about 7-8 years ago now, about the group of like STEM students. They were like the highly accelerated class that like went to the Houston Zoo, and one of them jumped into this jaguar exhibit. Like, that class is actively the class of a friend of mine. Like, I know the teacher whose class that was. Like, it's just mind numbing.
Yeah.
Like, what were you going to do? What were you going to do? You jumped into an exhibit with a jaguar.
A carnivorous animal.
Were you going to cuddle? But at the same time,
that's going to pan out.
just crazy. Just last year from Manga Bay, news and inspiration from nature's front lines was the study that suggested that the Tasmanian tiger survived into the 21st century. That was just a year ago, you know? And this is the fact of there are not just sightings, but sustained sightings of the Tasmanian tiger. This is an animal thought to have been hunted to extinction. There are regularly, and we had this conversation with our mutual friend, Daniel Allen Jones, Craig, the fact of there are regularly previously thought extinct species found. It's got to be a 1-to-4, 1-to-3 ratio almost. For every new species found every year, there's one that was either thought to be on the brink of extinction that's coming back, or one that was thought to be extinct that is found again.
Yeah, I mean, it happened, and still new animals are being discovered, species of animals every year. I think it's something like 20,000 of them. Now, granted,
most of them are small. To be conservative, it's into the hundreds.
You know, small insects and stuff, but still, every couple of years, something big, a mammal, a large mammal, is discovered that, you know, just like the mountain gorilla was ethno-known. It was known to the native people, but it wasn't known to science. And, you know, and then it shows up. You know, it was just 1902 that the mountain gorilla was officially cataloged by science.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very, very, very short amount of time.
Well, and not just that, it was more recent than that, that the coelacanth was rediscovered. That thing was a fossil. It was extinct, Jack, until it was caught off the coast of, what was it, like Morocco?
It was off the coast of, and maybe the first ones were Madagascar, maybe.
Yeah, Madagascar. The first ones.
1938.
Yeah, the first ones. It wasn't some anomaly that they just like popped up with one. You know, like there is a breeding population of them still. And when you're talking about things that have been talked about, like we were saying a minute ago, Craig, by civilizations the world over, same description. Identical description, identical characteristics, no different than saying is it a lowland gorilla, is it a highland gorilla, or you know, like a silverback gorilla. It's interesting to me how readily we are to dismiss that when all of about 10 years ago there was a whole species of deer discovered in Vietnam that was totally mythological as far as science was concerned. They had like air flaps on the side of their nose, and that was within the Vietnamese culture and the local dialogue for generations. They never lost sight of it in their local history. But science was like, you're a crazy person right now, till it was actively found.
Well, you know, there's that old adage that, you know, yesterday's magic is today's science.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have kept you long enough, Craig. We definitely want to have you on again and again and again, because things like this pop up in the news regularly. I am one of those folks. I had a cougar sighting in the woods of Kinder, Louisiana. And my family told me I was crazy. I kept pointing to the fact of, you know, they're called the Houston Cougars at U of H for a reason. Cougars once ranged regularly up around this area, and even now there is talk of the Jaguarundis making a comeback. It was once thought to be extinct, totally extinct, and then maybe like really, 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 really endangered. Like maybe there's two mating pair left. If there are any, and they're like way down in central Mexico. And now the sightings of Jaguarundis are getting so regular that like, they're talking about up in Dallas, man, like all kinds of stuff. So yeah, really interesting. We definitely want to have you on once again and again, but let's sure. go, for the last couple minutes into shameless self-promotion mode, Craig.
Okay. Well,
let everybody know where they can go to follow things, where they can go to buy tickets, all that good stuff.
Yeah, there's information on Facebook. The next event I have coming up is the Falk Monster Festival in Falk, Arkansas, home of the Falk Monster and the Legend of Boggy Creek. This year, this June, will actually be the 50th anniversary of the movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek. So there'll be other things going on there as well. But I have the Falk Monster Festival in Falk. Tickets are now on sale. You can go look up Falk Monster Festival on Facebook and get the information on registration for that event. I'm doing a new event. I'm still working on it. That is probably going to be in September in Jefferson. That's going to be Bigfoot related. That's still under.
Awesome.
In October, the 14th through 16th, the 21st annual Texas Bigfoot Conference will be held there. That's right. I've been doing it. This will be the 21st year.
Wow. Wow.
And we've got some cool guests, some people that haven't spoken at the event before. Some people that, local guys that come, you know, every year or two. And then we've got a new speaker. We've got a national, international speaker is one that's going to be speaking. And that's, you know, that tickets will probably won't go on sale until around April 1st for that. I've got the Bigfoot Film Festival in Marshall, Texas, tentatively scheduled for December 10th. This last December was awesome. We had Eduardo Sanchez, the writer, producer, director of the Blair Witch Project. He had
awesome.
The Bigfoot movie down by you in Bastrop back in 2013. And it came out in 2014, and I guarantee you it's the best Bigfoot movie ever. You get these guys that are making all these, you know, Bigfoot movies, and they try and make a scary Bigfoot movie.
What was once known as the, the Vice Guide to Bigfoot?
No.
Okay. Because, my wife does quite a bit of like judging and, panel leading, things like that for like Austin Film Festival. And I think it was kind of like a mockumentary called The Vice Guide to Bigfoot.
Yeah,
and now it's called something totally different because Vice got a hold of him and was like, listen, man, like we do actual investigative journalism. You can't do this. Good stuff, but utterly wild, funny movie. But
you know, Eduardo Sanchez, came and screened. Exist is the name of his movie that came out in 2014. Best Bigfoot movie ever. We screened several other films on the big screen. Eduardo had never even seen his movie all the way through, much less on the big screen.
Yeah,
several other. Movies that we screened, documentary, Southern Fried Bigfoot, you know, with Texas angle on it. I've already spoke to Bobcat Goldthwait about possibly screen Willow Creek this year. So I've got to follow up with him, but may be able to pull in Bobcat Goldthwait to screen Willow Creek.
Wow.
So those are my events for this year. So I've got June, October, and December with Bigfoot related events. I'm speaking in Jefferson the April 2nd, I think, History, Haunts, and Legends. It's about Bigfoot in East Texas. And then
awesome.
The same thing at the Tyler Paranormal conference, and I think that's mid to end of April.
Awesome. And you know, don't ever forget, folks, about the site that started it all, at least for me, when it comes to cryptids, cryptid news, cryptic creatures and their legends and myths here in America and beyond, cryptomundo.com. Craig, I can't thank you enough for coming back on the show once again. I can't wait to have you on again and again and again. I cannot wait to come out to the Texas Bigfoot Conference, Folk Monster Festival, things like that, and start doing live streams out there with you guys. It's going to be super
awesome.
Fun.
You know, and, you know, you had plenty of people that, you know, probably have a Bigfoot story that'd probably be happy to tell it to you.
Exactly.
And I'll try and make it out to Mineola, at least briefly to come see you out there and meet you in person.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't wait for Mineola. It's going to be super fun. I actively, just so you know, folks, if you're planning on going to Mineola, there is one of the most haunted hotels in Texas in the heart of Mineola that just reopened like 6 months ago. You go to their website and it's like, hey, yeah, you know, book the ballroom, come by, do some stuff in the bar. But you got to dig and dig and dig to find an email. And I did. And I was like, you got rooms? And they were like, yeah, we got rooms. I'm like, doesn't seem like you got rooms.
So are you into that kind of paranormal stuff?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Oh, golly.
The event that I'm doing in September in Jefferson at a overnight paranormal investigation at the haunted historic Jefferson Hotel that is very haunted.
Awesome.
But I've got a group of a female Sasquatch research team from up north, but they started out doing paranormal investigations and such.
Cool.
And they interviewed Lauren Coleman on their show, and he told them that they should also investigate Sasquatch because females aren't as threatening as males may be. And so they are the she squatchers. So they're going to come down and do a Sasquatch presentation, but they're also bringing all their paranormal equipment and going to do an overnight paranormal investigation at this haunted hotel.
Wow.
So you'll have to get in on that one too.
Oh, most definitely, man. Like I said, let's definitely hook up. Let's get some things going because I'm ready to get out there and start getting this stuff out to the people. That's my part in all of this. And I have skill sets. I have access to a lot of things that, will help get it out to the people. And I'm all about that. So let's definitely make some things happen.
That sounds like, Liam Neeson in Taken.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've
a set of skills.
Yeah. Yeah. I have enough knowledge to be fully dangerous in a lot of ways, Craig. Let's just put it that way.
Well, that could get you in trouble, but it could also get you out of trouble.
It could be honed into amazing, fantastic things as well. So I look forward to collaborating with people like you and Daniel Allen Jones, Nick Redfern, all those guys here in Texas, you know, Blackburn. All those guys.
Guess what? I'm actually doing the show right now from Lyle Blackburn's couch.
Hey, Lyle.
you're on the
list to contact, buddy.
I can definitely put you in touch. And if you also want to talk to the ones that were on that show, Killing Bigfoot.
Yes. Yes.
I can put you in touch with those guys.
I would love both of those, man, because that's just it. I think that this is a conversation that needs to be had. I am not a paranormal Bigfoot guy by any stretch of the imagination. I am not I'm not going to say that Bigfoot isn't connected with UFOs and we need to do a whole episode on that, because there are definitely a lot of crosses in those things. But I am not a big hole manipulates wormholes.
Yeah, but you know what? You know what? When people ask me about that, there's far more reports of people seeing and interacting and being close with UFOs. But that doesn't mean that they are connected.
Yeah, no, no, no. It doesn't mean that they aren't mutually that they are mutually exclusive from each other, or that they aren't connected in some way.
Because, you know, personally, I think that, you know, Bigfoot seemed to be curious about people. You know, if they saw strange lights in the sky where they don't normally see lights, they might be curious to see what that is and be drawn to it. And then someone else may see, you know, the UFO and see a Bigfoot nearby and then make the connection that, well, certainly that Bigfoot has something to do with that UFO.
Well, and much like any animal out there, and I'm not saying that Bigfoot is fully animal. I'm not saying that he's part.
Right.
I'm just saying like anything that has lived in the wild.
Right.
For the amount of time that it would have had to sustain itself, Craig, it would be tuned into A, what's around it, and B, what's safe. And it, even though it's curious, if that's something that like it, I would assume the fact that to make it this long, it would have to be a somewhat intelligent species.
Sure.
Because it's not top of the food chain. By and that's a whole nother episode in and of itself, you know, like, I mean, I really do. Bigfoot's big, but it ain't top of the food chain. It ain't like, hey, yeah, I'm going to go out and hunt a cougar.
Yeah.
You know, so
or a killer whale.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
And when you're talking about why there's more sightings in the big thicket area than Bandera or West Texas or here in the hill country, straight up, yeah, like you said, rainfall, man. If you're going to be a creature in an omnivore of that size, I'm not going to say that Bigfoot ain't going to munch a squirrel, you know, maybe, maybe even take down a raccoon, rabbit,
right,
something along those lines, you know. But omnivore like that, yeah, you've definitely got to have full-on grazing capability and something that would sustain the size of a black bear or larger.
Sure.
When it comes to berries, nuts, fruits, things like that. So, like I said, those are entire episodes in and of themselves, Craig, and I cannot wait. Blessings to you. Thank you so much for all you have done all these years with Crypto Mundo, everything that you are doing with the Texas Bigfoot Museum, Texas Bigfoot Film Festival, the Folk Monster Festival. Man, I can't wait to come and be a sponsor and do everything I can at all of them. Thank you so much for your time. And I'd say hold on through the break or anything like that, but feel free to tune in. We have a whole nother guest after this commercial break. We will definitely be in touch, Craig. Thank you so much for your time. We're going to go ahead and let you go, my friend.
Okay. Have a good evening, the rest of your evening, and let's keep in touch and
plan to talk. Absolutely. I will share links to this tomorrow when everything posts, all that kind of good stuff. Thanks again.
Okay. Have a good one.
All right. Take care. Man. What an incredible conversation. I am so glad to have had Craig Woolheater on this new incarnation of things. It's been way too long since he was on Dudes and Beer to begin with, but to know that he is here on Curious Realm and all that kind of good stuff is just fantastic. Hold on through this break, folks. We'll be right back with our fantastic friend Mike Turber, who is standing in for the scheduled Dr. John Hall. Get well, John Hall. We'll talk to you soon. And right after this, folks, we'll get into it with Mike Turber. Stay tuned. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training. And use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is PodcastCadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. And we are back, folks. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors. Full disclosure, I am one of the owners of Podcast Cadet. I love podcasting so much. Me and a couple other people came up with that system to help folks out there trying to build a brand out of a show for your business, things like that. So it's a little bit different than casual podcasting, but we help casual podcasters too. Feel free to contact us. Feel free to stop on by the Curious Realm store, curiousrealm.com/store is the address. Tons of great swag over there. Tons of fantastic books. We got our book links fixed, folks. So the whole bookstore is back. Look at that. Just tons and tons and tons of books from guests. We have some great upcoming guests in the next week, stuff like that. While you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by YouTube and check out 5x5 News. That is the channel from the amazing, the awesome Mike Turber. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing excellent now that I got that wonderful introduction there. That's awesome. Thank you, sir.
You know, you're close to you're close to our heart, and let's just leave it at that.
We don't want to go any further.
We love you in ways that might be illegal in some places, Mike. The topics that you have been willing to come on to our show and disclose, the things that you have been willing to come on to our show and talk about. I remember whenever you first came on, it was, of course, about the Vegas shooting from our good friend Shannon Ray Caffey. But
I just talked to Shannon just a few minutes ago.
As did I, via Facebook. Yeah.
Exactly.
Shout out to you and to T-shirt Toad. We'll actually be having a commercial from T-shirt Toad coming out soon. I need to produce that. So
reminds me, I got to get him to do me some shirts.
For me, it's you know. From there, we went into Area 51 and the whole labeling of conspiracy theory as a flag word by the FBI and the Naruto run and, you know, what was going to happen when a bunch of people stormed Area 51. It's been a while. And then Tiger King, like you went out and started investigating Tiger King stuff.
Yeah, that was enough.
I live vicariously through people like you. Michael, because your life is just a nonstop, never ending adventure.
It's like if I sat at a bar or something, which has happened where I was sitting there and you start chatting about something. Of course, naturally the subject of something that I've been involved in comes up, and then you start telling them about it, and then you start realizing, man, I probably shouldn't have said that because they're not going to believe it. And then the next subject comes up, and you talk about Tiger King, then UFOs, and then we talk about Las Vegas shooting, and they're like, okay, wait a minute, you're full of crap.
No way you're investigating all this. But that is exactly what you do at 5x5 News, is you go out and get into the thick of it, man. You were the one that exposed the utterly open back doors and elevators at MGM, stuff like that with the amazing reporter there. You're still hanging on to that. Like, one of the first videos that you have up on 5x5 News is the What Happened in Vegas, the money machine stuff. And we definitely need to revisit that whenever time comes around for that again with you and Ram Dennison, because the work that you guys did on that, there's a reason why it won digital film awards and things like that during COVID, because it was absolutely well produced, and the information that's there that shows how using a hashtag Boston Strong campaign, they were able to curry millions of dollars that just ended up disappearing and did not go to victims.
Exactly. Well, we finally found out that where the money went and the dollar amount that people got. I did finally find that out. It was after we had already produced what we had done. Oddly enough, some of the information I worked out as I was talking to Eric Paddock, the brother of the shooter, which I'm going to see probably Friday, because he lives right here. He lives right in Orlando, right about probably 30 miles from me. I might do a live cast from that if he's up to it. So we can see what's going on. But we found out that the money was paid out, but it was like not when they needed it. These people needed that money then. Exactly.
Well, even right now, you were involved in a huge humanitarian cause. Give us an update, at least as much as you can. You are further than hip deep above the navel involved with exfiltrating people from the literal hot mess that we left in our wake in Afghanistan, man. And whenever I am still seeing articles about this, whenever I still see you talking about this and the efforts that are going on, it is one of those things that just utterly roils me from the core.
Yeah, it's a bad situation pretty much all the way around. It's very it's hard to find the good points out of it, and the position that I'm in is kind of in a weird liaison slash, you know, I'm like a case manager. I have over 5,000 people on my manifest, of which probably over 1,000 are people that I can probably legitimately get out. And then you get down the list to, you know, there's an individual whose family is on this, on my list that was given to me by I can't say who he is yet, but I'll let you know, I think. But anyway, so this individual was entrusted, to me, by a director of a national security slash intel agency from before. So it was just once it comes out, but I don't know. But anyway, so he gave me this family because it was super important. And I didn't even know who the individual was until about a month after I was into it. I just took over whatever families he sent to me and just like said, okay, this is a favor to him. And then I found out who the person is, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. But it's a super high value target. And you know, trying to get him to be safe with all the things that, you know, he's a super high value target. Taliban's actively looking for him and his family and stuff like this. So we're constantly having to move them around. So he's on his third or fourth safe house now. And it's just, you know, and then coming up with the ability to move people there. It's weird that here I am in the middle of Florida trying to do things over there and the various means that we have to do it. All of my people go through, you know, representative in our government. And then to the Department of State. So we're backed up that way. And then we still actively pursue trying to evacuate these people. And the Department of State stopped the flights for over a month. They just recently, as of like last five or six days ago, started the flights back up. And that was a huge mess. When you tell somebody it's going to be at least a month before we can even begin to try to get you out, you have to be in the minds of these people. They are trying to stay alive. And they can't like go shopping. They can't do hardly anything because you're basically harboring them in a home. And now you tell them you got a whole another month of this at minimum. And, that's just gut wrenching, man. It's so hard to have to go through that. But, you know, it's our government that, kind of created the issue. Anybody can point fingers to Biden or Trump or whatever, and everybody will have points on both sides. But right now, my feeling is that our current administration has an opportunity to fix this. And it's been, everybody's forgotten about what's going on over there. I mean, it's just it's not on everyday news, and it's very frustrating, but we're working on it, and getting them out slowly but surely. But,
well, and the fact that, like you said, it's not on everyday news, that it is something like we are seeing stuff about false flags and, you know, about us responding to false flags, claiming that there's false flags, all kinds of stuff about the Ukraine. But and even stuff about China and what's going on over there. And, you know, people getting swooped off the street while they're doing news reports about snowboarders. But But I'll be darned if we can pay attention to stuff like this that is still actively going on.
It is. It is. And they went through a really harsh winter and, you know, just trying to get blankets to the house. You have to go through. God, it'd be hard. I'd have to show you it one day so you can see the
snowed over there recently.
Yeah. Well, they've been really cold.
It did in some parts like Israel and stuff like that, I know, but.
Right. But imagine trying to get enough money over to a person over there who can't receive money in whatever, in Kabul or in Mazar or Sharif or, you know, wherever they are.
Yeah.
And you try to get that to them so that they can get blankets or have blankets delivered to them. It's like a 9-step process that you have to go through. You can't use a normal bank system. You can't just go to your local Walmart and grab
And I was going to say, especially now, because there's the whole thing coming out right now about the whole trucker strike
in Canada,
and GoFundMe. And the fact that there was like $9 million donated to those guys. And not only did GoFundMe not give it to them and to the people organizing it, but they gave it directly to charities that were totally opposite. And it's like, yo, there's some international wire fraud.
And GoFundMe is GoFundMe charity shutting down. So.
Yeah. And I was going to say, you know, especially with that, with PayPal, things like that, these were typically the ways that people could support and provide money for an effort like what's going on and like what you were putting on. And right now, especially with the fact of you have to report that now, everything else, not that what you're doing is shady or shadowy or anything like that, but it's definitely something that, you know, probably a good majority of the government wants you having no finger involved in.
Well, here's the magic thing about me. Absolutely every investigation and or operation I have done has been self-funded.
Yeah.
Everything. I have not had any outside sources of funds. Now, it's getting to the point where with Afghanistan, if we don't get people, if we don't get all these people out soon enough, I'm going to have to open up some way to be funded, because there's just right now not $1. And, you know, Vegas cost me over $40,000. You know, all these different things. I'm not saying it's a woe is me kind of thing. It's a choice that I made because I didn't want people to say, oh, you're in this for the money. And then when I tell them, I said, look, I'm not monetized on YouTube. I have no sponsors. I have no one, you know, saying, hey, we're going to fund you this money, you know, quiet wise or above the board or anything. Zero. And I feel comfortable, with that. So once it's going to be weird if I ever get to the point where someone funds me to do an operation like this, it's just,
I gave you a beer when you came to my house.
Yeah, you did.
That's, I mean, I at least pulled my weight on that end.
I'm going to have to submit that back to them and let them know, I forgot about this beer. Are you guys going to,
that's right. But I mean, but seriously, it is the fact of, and so many people forget that about so many investigators that are out there following these passions, doing this stuff, doing this right thing.
It's a volunteer network. I mean,
even this show, like, yeah, man, we got donate links. We got a store, everything else. Like I run a podcast network. Yeah. I can't say that it has broken even at any point, between my cost of websites and RSS feeds and memberships and platforms. Yeah. And,
I can tell you this, when I did put out a thing when I was doing the 5x5 news for the Las Vegas thing. I put out one of the first few weeks I was there, and then that's when I backpedaled and took that off. But out of the first 2 months I had that up on my channel where people could donate or whatever, I received $18.
Yeah.
So I have, that's it, you know, so it's not I know that no one's going to get, you know, rich off of this thing unless they have like a million, you know, subscribers and they're doing ads and monetized. But that to me shows a possible lenience towards bias. And
it's the fact of because you don't have money coming in from it, you are not beholden to anybody or their stake in the game or their skin in the game by being a sponsor or anything like that. And you know, that's something to be said. Absolutely. Even the same thing here, the fact of the sponsors that we do have are things that I insist that I personally use them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I refuse to. And this is nothing against anybody out there who owns a squatty potty that is in my audience. Good on you. Works great for a lot of people. And nothing against any host out there or producer out there that has gotten their host squatty potty money. Go get it, son. You want to sell like panties.com. Go out there, get 100,000 downloads a month and get your panties.com money. Go get your stamps.com money. Whatever.
Did you test the squatty potty and it not work for you? What happened?
Hey man, I'm not bitter like that. But they told me at a dinner. They told me at a dinner. I'm just playing.
I mean, I had all kinds of visions going through my head, like accidents, or like you went through and it just exploded on you or something.
The product video went horribly awry.
Like the spatial equipment with reverse flow or something.
But the fact is, you know, it's kind of like why I don't edit the show. I don't edit the show because, man, with the miracle of editing, even with video, folks, you can do a lot of things. You can chop things up and make things into whatever the heck you want. So I don't edit the show for that reason, because I don't want people's message being abridged or chopped up, or, you know, something that I may think is just in passing is actively an integral part, you know?
Gotta be extra careful when you're on this show. Don't want to slip up, but that's cool.
Oh yeah.
I actually prefer it that way.
And I mean, it's interesting to me, Mike, to know in the time that we have known each other and the time that we've worked together and that you've been on my show, and that I've been on your show before too. It's been interesting to see some of the things that we have talked about kind of come to fruition. When you were talking about technologies that are out there and available,
right?
You know, nuclear technologies, fusion technologies, nanotechnologies, metamaterials, things like that. Let's kind of start getting into some of the things that have come about since this whole UAP thing popped on the radar in 2017, because it's been about 5 years now since that announcement was made by Lou Elizondo on CNN. Yeah. That was December
16th, 2017. Yeah, that was right after the Las Vegas shooting. I was right in the middle of going into the second month of investigation on that, and then this came out, and I was all excited, all hacked up for it, and then you saw what happened to me. Then I realized, wow, this sounds really familiar. Once Dave Beatty came out with that Nimitz encounter video, that was when I was like, wait a second, this is starting to sound really familiar. And then, of course, the rest is history as far as being tied into it.
Sure.
But there's a lot of technology that this is why you want to have Jack on your show too, where he basically has solved the problem of the propulsion and the ability to do it, and answered a lot of questions as to why things would look the way they do and why things would act the way they do. And a lot of people have that misconception that if an object is turning 900 G's or something like this, that the person would be jellyfied inside the craft, which is exactly what I thought was going to happen. But come to find out, if you're inside of a warp bubble, you don't experience any of the G's at all, because you're essentially... Yeah. You're in the warp bubble, but you're essentially removed from movement. In fact, you're not moving at all. You're kind of like pulling space towards you and pushing it away from you behind. So you're not moving.
Well, that's a weird concept. Well, the example that I gave last time that we talked about this, Mike, was putting a bubble inside of a straw and sealing it on both ends and kind of like pushing pressure on one side. You'll see the bubble move and then come back. And it's kind of the same concept, where whatever would be inside of that bubble would be totally unaffected and move at whatever speed that bubble is moving at.
Yep. We need to make a big, big straw and test that one.
Yeah. Just a big piece of clear PVC.
Yep.
You know?
Or we could borrow Elon Musk's Hyperloop tube and we could do a live sale.
Yeah, absolutely. We could go like 15 miles an hour underneath Vegas.
I actually was in Hawthorne at the Hyperloop is right outside their building in Hawthorne. The miniaturized test track thing.
Yeah.
To know that something went through that, you can go through a tube without any air in it, basically a vacuum chamber, and because you have no air resistance, there's no speed limit.
Yeah.
They're technically, and if you're doing a magnetic levitation type train, then there's really no limit to the speed. So people put on that you can go 7,000 miles an hour or whatever. No, you can go as fast as, pretty much as fast as you want.
Yeah, precisely. And that's just it. Once again, once you're inside of that warp bubble, and this was first put out, there was the Alcubierre White warp drive. And then Dr. Sonny White just recently put out his warp bubble paper. Feel free to stop on by, folks. Go to curiousrealm.com/knowledge/studies. That will take you to our knowledge vault in the scientific studies and docs section. You can actively click and download and get the warp bubble document entitled Worldline Numerics Applied to Custom Casimir Geometry Generates Unanticipated Intersection with Alcubierre Warp Metric. It's a mouthful. It's a mouthful. Uh-huh. And I would highly recommend that you go also download the from our declassified section, I believe it's in the Alcubierre White Warp Drive. Because that's going to explain some of the terminology. I guess it's in UFO and paranormal here. There it is, Alcubierre White Warp Drive. Whenever you start reading that, it'll give you some prelims for that warp bubble. Because like they said in the title of that, it was the intersection with the Alcubierre White factor that made them confirm the fact that they'd accidentally created a warp bubble.
Yeah. Or they accidentally created the conditions in which the warp bubble should have.
Yes.
Should have formed and or existed.
Yeah.
I listened to the reporter that did that was I think it was Chris on the debrief. Was it a debrief or the intercept? It was a debrief.
Debrief.
So when he explained the conversation that he had with Sonny after he put out his story, and you got to see that video if you haven't seen it. It's really interesting to watch because I think it was on. It's either Alien Scientist Jeremy's channel or another podcast. I'm trying to remember the name of it. But so listening to that explanation as to how that error came up and how just one word or two can change a huge amount of what the perception of the public is going to be as far as that whether or not a warp bubble was created or not. Man, talk about an internet storm that created.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was in the news for at least a few weeks.
Yeah. And people are still publishing things saying that he created a warp bubble. You know, it's just there's no way to police it after the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah.
So that was it.
And it's interesting because, the fact is, yes, like you said, he didn't actively create a warp bubble, but he did create the circumstances in which one theoretically could or should exist.
Right.
So you're able to create that circumstance to begin with.
Is
a revelatory step in the process.
Absolutely. And it's so funny when you think about this, it was Sonny White that did both. If Sonny White he advanced the Alcubierre drive so that it would not require all of the energy in the universe to go at the speed of light. And they basically reduced that number down drastically. I think Jack Sarfati has reduced it down even further. So we have all of these different physicists and theoretical physicists going out there to do this. And then you have the theoretical physicists, astrophysicist Sonny White that has created that new drive. So it's Alcubierre White drive is the same scientist in a completely unrelated experiment after he left the NASA Eagle Works and what have you. To study the Casimir effect and creates it inside his new experiment. It's amazing that what are the odds of that? I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah. And granted, there have been some decriers that are, of course, saying that you cannot quantify your own research, things like that. Basically the fact of, like you said, what are the odds of it?
Right.
Is he falsifying results in order to achieve his own result?
But the other question is would someone else even be able to identify what they had done? And see, he recognized the math and recognized that, wow, we're really close to creating the effect that I need to create this warp bubble. Just like the accidental creation of a black hole. Everybody's worried about the machine that can, that's here now that could probably do that. will it eat the Earth? No, of course not. There's probably micro black holes that happen all the time.
Yeah.
But this is a micro nano, you know, scale warp bubble. And anyone else would have missed it. They would not even have seen the numbers gel in such a way that this would have been theoretically created or the possibility of it being created.
Yeah.
Only he would recognize that. So that's why I kind of err on his side. Listening to his explanation was enlightening, to say the least, because, you know, beforehand you sit there and you listen to this stuff, and after a while you kind of get numb to it.
Yeah.
But listening to him explain it after the fact was kind of neat, because it created one hell of a storm. So
yeah. They actively create black holes all the time. I mean, here's an article from news18.com. Israeli physicists create black hole in lab. Yep. You know, these things are like the size. They're small, folks, like microscopic, size of the head of a pin. And they exist for moments, mere moments.
Right.
But even now, with the new magnetic fields that we are working with, the new intensity of magnetic field, everything else, which is allowing us to harness quite literally the power of the sun, within the footprint of a home, you know, these new fusion centers and stuff like that in China and forthright in other places, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, the one Lockheed Martin was working on that they said would be ready in 5 years, that was back in 2014.
Yeah,
and that was the size of a car or smaller. So
yeah, that was the size of an 18-wheeler they were talking about at that point. Yeah. And that they would be able to five-generation that annually.
Right. And here's the other question that naturally people, you know, listening to the show are going to have in their back of their mind. That if they've already created this stuff, if they already have it, are they suppressing this technology to make certain that the transition to it doesn't affect the current industry? That's a big question, because you got coal industry, you got the petroleum industry. Exactly. And even solar and stuff like this. I mean, if you can get unlimited energy from hydrogen that this planet has plenty of, the whole universe has plenty of, then you've reached the holy grail of everything.
Yeah.
And it's unlimited at that point. But you think our government would put much more emphasis on funding the research for this than they do? Because I was looking back and I said, this is one of the fundamental things that's reachable, especially within our lifetime, that we can achieve this amount of this technology, the fusion technology, that why hasn't there been more efforts from various governments, much less our own, to funding the research to make this a reality? I mean, whoever comes up with this technology first wins the game, right?
Wins the game, but cripples the global power conglomerate.
Yep.
When it comes to how much money you make per megawatt going into each home globally, you have to think about it in that right, folks. You really do, because unfortunately, it's the fact of, and Mike and I were talking before the show. I've been amazed at all the videos and pictures and things like that, and just reports of like the F-35 jet, this amazing piece of $78 million a piece, $78 million price tag. They have a contract to produce 156 of them a year.
Yep.
That is 96 plus billion dollars. That's a B, folks. That's like, it's insane. It's asinine, the amount of money. And yet still, as we say on the show all the time, Mike, we think it's some kind of kerfuffle to give people a hand up, not a hand out. You know, like we couldn't afford to give everybody in the country $300 a month that's 18 and up. Yeah, we really could. We really could. You know, start doing the math real quick. You know, I just did the math of us like cutting that number in a third. Like, let's take 50 out of 156. I don't know where they get the arbitrary number of 156. You know, like, well, you know, there's going to be some breakage. That's why we give you a baker's dozen of glasses, you know, because about one of them is going to break on the stem.
Probably because you can't fit 13 in the box.
Oddly enough, we give you the planes in 13, but our carriers only hold 11.
Well, the thing about this, too,
like hot dogs and buns is how they do it, you know?
Yeah,
like,
if you look at them.
you gotta buy a certain number of carriers and planes for them to even out.
That's right.
You know, like you gotta buy 80. Yeah, you gotta buy 80 hot dogs before it works out. That's only because you get 8 in one and 10 in the other. And it's like, what is that, Jack, dude? How many times am I having 80 people at my house to eat up some hot dogs?
Sorry, somebody's a math genius here. But you don't know, was it the hot dog industry that benefits, or was it the bun industry?
It's just a devious damn mind, whichever one came up with it.
Yeah. I've always wondered, those things like that, I always sit back and I wonder, I say, now, what idiot designed this? Like, you ate hot dogs, and then you got the pack of buns, and it never matches. I mean, did these two people not talk to each other?
You travel a lot. I travel a lot. My joke all the time, whenever they ask me if I want a second key for my room, is like, where do you think that thing's going to be if I get locked out of my room?
Exactly.
Just curious. Do you think it's in my wallet that's in my room, or you think it's in my room like my other card?
You're supposed to have the spare keys, so when you're at the bar and you're girl, you just gotta hand it to her and walk away see what happens.
Like put it under the inside of my shoe, you know, like a quarter when you're a kid, just in case you got to go home. put it under the sole of your shoe.
It's so funny because I've got like a whole stack of these hotel room keys that I have in my truck, and I look at it now and then. I keep seeing the Mandalay Bay one that's obviously really interesting, but it's kind of a history of where you go.
Yeah.
And I checked into the Howard Johnson's about 2 weeks ago, and the guy was trying to explain to me how you can't put a magnet next to that key here because blah, blah, blah.
It'll demagnetize the key.
Yeah, it'll basically erase the strip or whatever. I said, can you explain to me how that happens? And he goes, I said, do you know what's on that strip? It's gammaspheric oxide or anything like that? Does that sound familiar? And so I stumped the guy. I was just playing with the guy. And I was like, look, I said, the odds of me magnetically screwing around with this key are one thing. But if you guys have that much of a problem that's the first thing you say to me when you give me the keys, you might want to switch keys to a different key set.
You might want to get a different system rolling. Yeah.
Exactly. Upgrade your system because, you know, it's like the 80s called. They want their room keys back.
Well, and just to bring that back, talking about systems and updating systems, that was a lot of our original concept whenever we were talking about the Nimitz encounters, things like that, was the idea of the passive radar system that the Nimitz had and that other carriers in the fleet had at the time. And was it possibly a test between Air Force, Navy, without necessarily not without one branch knowing, but without like radar operators knowing?
Well, and that's where my conversations with Kevin Day have actually come to fruition just in the last 2 weeks alone. Oh, wow. I haven't even discussed this with you yet because I'm going to put the information out, but I did FOIA requests. Here's the question. When Kevin Day said that he saw objects in groups of 5 or 10 coming down from San Clemente Island, you know, they would just appear just over San Clemente, and they would drop, you know, remember he said there's raining UFOs, they would drop from over 80,000 feet, come down to about 28,000 feet, track south at about 100 knots. So I started looking at this, and I said, wow, I wonder what the velocity of the air or wind is at 28,000 feet. So I look it up, and sure enough, it's 100 knots on that date. So then I thought, well, then there's only a few objects that are affected by the wind. So, and I go, here we go again. I'm going to say that this UFO is probably a balloon, but I can't do that without any, you know, anything to back it up. So sure enough, I contact, I realized that Kevin Day said the following thing. He said that he started noticing these on November 10th and they stopped on November 16th. So on November 16th of that same year, 2004, was the test of the X-43 hypersonic missile. And so when that test happened, the week leading up to it, they had to check the wind speeds at various altitudes because it was going to launch from 24,000 feet and go up to 90 to 110,000 feet at hypervelocity, which means any air movement either way could cause a catastrophe for that object. And guess where? And it was testing in the exact same area where the Nimitz was. And the track for that object was 850 miles. So I started piecing this all together. I said, wow, this is really starting to be very coincidental that he was tracking 5 to 10 objects. So then I decided, let me contact NASA and find out what they did with the weather balloons. So sure enough, they launched 2 weather balloons from St. Nicholas Island, 2 weather balloons from Point Magoo, and 1 weather balloon from Vandenberg Air Force Base. There's your 5. And they did that at least twice a day up to the launch. But this was not seen on regular, you know, weather balloon, you know, tracking stations or whatever. This was all special balloons just for that one event. And so I contacted NASA in the fastest FOIA I ever had. I contacted them like on the...
Which I am actively showing on screen.
Oh, you have it? Okay, perfect.
Like, I already knew where you were going, dude.
Awesome.
That's how creepy our relationship is. Like, it's not creepy enough in your head. You need me in there.
There you go. And because you and I are doing video, I don't get to see it. So, yeah. So, if you look at it, you'll see the date on there. Well, I think I got it on the 12th or something like that. And I submitted it. You look at the difference between the date and the time I got that first answer back. That's amazing because normally your FOIAs are going to be months or years in some cases. I was amazed to get this back, but I received a phone call first, and then they actually let me talk to the weather station at Edwards Air Force Base, which was controlling all of that, all the weather phenomena. Yeah. And guess what piece of information he gave me? And his name is Edward, by the way. The guy at Edwards Air Force Base happened to be named Edward. That was kind of funny.
In the Office of Education. Officer Ben.
Yeah.
Ed, the there you go. Ed's.
I'm Mr. Ed. Officer. So in talking to him, I said, let me ask you this. I said, how do you guys track the balloons? He said, well, some are GPS, some are not, you know, some are this or that. And some they use reflectors on and they keep a beam heading towards the reflector, all these different things. And he said, I explained to him, I said, what do you think the odds are that the balloons you guys are launching might be related to the Nimitz event of the UAP encounter? And he said he never really thought about it. So I explained to him my theory. In the middle of me explaining it to him, he goes, wow, that kind of explains quite a few things for us, too, because they were not able to track these balloons until after the Princeton received its new radar. Get this. Princeton received a Spy 1B upgrade on their radar system. Kevin Day did not even know this occurred because Kevin Day did not have the security clearance, even though he managed the whole thing and ran the whole show, didn't have the security clearance to know that there was an upgrade done. So these objects that they had never seen before all of a sudden start appearing on their radar system. And the reason that we kind of surmised and came up with was because after the upgrade, the radar was able to see balloons, whereas before they never tracked balloons. They would not show up even on the advanced radar that the Princeton had would not show up. So fast forward, if you want.
Sure. It's not a solid object, and whatever basket or payload it's carrying is normally about the size of a small child.
Right. So and if you don't put
anything that would show up on radar would be like, hey, look at that sparrow flying through the sky.
Right.
If even that.
Unless they put reflectors on it, which they don't do. So when you fast forward now, and the Air Force was testing several other things at the same time. The Navy was testing the some of the earlier versions of DRFM technology, which you and I have discussed before.
Yep.
And so if you factor in all of these different things, you start to form a picture of what may have actually occurred. And so it starts to make sense. But of course, you know, when you go against the narrative of what a lot of people believe, then they naturally will fight back, which is fine. I prefer that. I don't want someone to just accept anything I say at face value. So I think I even sent. Did I send you the balloon data? Did you get that? I don't remember if I sent it.
I can't remember if you sent me that or not, Michael.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to try to piece it together and put it in the form of a video that would make sense. So it makes a visual statement as to the point I'm trying to put across.
Absolutely. Yeah. But even still, I was just scrolling through all the specs of the phased array that you're talking about, the SPY-1B and everything and all that. And whenever you're talking about, especially the new weaponry, that isn't even like theoretical, does it exist? They proudly mm-hmm. admit that we have hypersonic technology. We are still testing our hypersonic missile. We have yet to have a full on successful go with the hypersonic missile, but we know Russia has them. We know China has them.
China has them. Yep.
So.
And the railgun is effectively a hypersonic missile launcher when you think about it.
Absolutely. So. And, you know, I've had people in the group be like, oh, well, you know, a laser will handle that. Well, you got to be able to target something that's going hypersonically, number one. And not that we don't have some great systems out there beyond Patriot, like Iron Dome, things like that are out there now. Yeah. Multiple target tracking systems, all kinds of stuff.
It's so like the Princeton can track
systems.
Yeah, the Princeton can track over 100,000 objects at one time.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's a classified number, but it's not that big of a deal because whatever.
But I mean, the thing is, the whole purpose behind the passive as opposed to the active is by the time an active radar ping got back to you,
right? Yeah,
the distance between that object and your reading would be vast.
Yeah, it might be on you.
There would be no way to accurately be like, it's this far away, Captain. Like, no way. No way.
Because you're waiting for that distance.
10,000 miles an hour. So by the time that radar comes back, it may be quiet where you are now.
eerily
quiet.
And here's the cool thing about SPY-1B radar. It has different modes that you can put it on. This is not widely known to the public, but if you put it in a mode that does not track objects moving that fast, meaning ballistic mode, so it has a mode where it can track ballistic missiles coming in.
Sure.
And it was not in that mode, so it would show objects that were blipping across the screen and trying to piece it together and saying that these are the exact same object. Well, all of the radar signatures off of a weather balloon would be identical between one or another. It would appear the same on radar. And so that's one of the other things that I'll have to, you know, put into this whole theory that I have of what actually occurred. And so everything makes sense. But you're right. You know, like the E2 Hawkeye that has the radar distance moving around at the top. And by the time that thing swings back around, those objects would have traveled hundreds of miles, possibly.
Yeah. Precisely. Yeah. Any kind of targeting technology or whatever would have to be able to keep up with that, follow it real time and anticipate its move, which would have to be beyond the realm of fully AI. I would say that, and granted, we got some incredible AI out there, folks. Like, we've already seen in the last 2 years, AI beat out human pilot.
Yep.
Three out of five. And that was best of three. Like, hey, sorry you didn't get one. We were going for best of five. The AI just won three in a row.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And just like it won the game in China, the game where an AI program actually beat the hardest game where you had to remember all these different combinations. Not like chess, where Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue. You know, then you have Google that went out and beat the guy that was the head of the game. What was it? Whatever the game is in China, I can't remember. It's Macular or something like that. I can't remember the name of it. So you have that. And then fast forward to 2015 with the second incident involving an aircraft carrier during its training, during its workups to go on a cruise. And you have these objects that are appearing, according to Ryan Graves, who was a pilot. He said they were seeing them every day for 2.5 years. But he did release some information that made me think something else again. I know it was the tidbits of information that someone might not pick up on. But one of the things he said was that, you know, they talked about the object, the cube and the sphere. Remember that?
Yeah.
That was the plane. If the plane was flying along and this object flew past him. When in fact, when he was asked more about it, he said, well, actually, he thinks that the object was stationary and they flew by it. Immediately, that patent came up in my mind about the reflector that is a cube inside of a sphere. That's what they saw. Oh. And I was wondering, when do they use this? So Ryan Graves was asked a poignant question. The question was how many of these objects did the pilots report seeing with their own eyes? Yeah. Out of the hundred, obviously it had to be hundreds because they're seeing them every day for 2.5 years. He said that they saw probably 8 to 12, and each and every single one of those visual ideas, the visuals on that object were all the cube and the sphere. And that tells me that Mercury Systems, which creates a DRFM technology that they were using on the Roosevelt, I have confirmed that, that they tend to use these reflectors to push the energy wave out further. It's just like you lose line of sight over a certain distance of the horizon. And so that these reflectors, which is what that cube in the sphere is exactly that. And it gives the appearance of hundreds of whatever these objects are. Remember when the pilot says, there's a whole fleet of them. You know, look at your SA, which is your situational awareness screen. And so when they looked at that, they said there's a whole fleet of them. And that's exactly what that system is designed to do. So anyone listening, look up Mercury Systems and put in U.S. Navy or whatever, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. So I called Mercury Systems just to see what would happen. And I got the guy on. I got a guy on the phone. They don't answer the phone. You have to call them and then leave a number or whatever, and they call back. And so the guy called me back, and we talked for about quite a few minutes actually. And I asked him a question. I said, I know you can't, because we'd already discussed what we could and can't talk about. I said, can you tell me that at what application would the Navy normally use the DRFM in? He says, oh, they always use it during red team, blue team. Where the red team will fly in with the DRFM on a Super 18, you know, a Super Hornet Growler or what have you, or another aircraft, and broadcast like that aircraft carrier group is being attacked by 200 to 500 planes or whatever it is they want to do. And on their screens, it looks identical to what have you. Exactly. So people are saying, yeah, but they saw it with their own eyes. I said, I couldn't argue that. I said, yeah, you know, you're right. You know, from what I understood was they were seeing it with their own eyes. But then when Ryan Graves said that all they saw was 8 to 12 and they were all that cube in the sphere, boom, that just opened the door for me on figuring out Roosevelt, figuring out Nimitz, and going, okay.
And you know, Mike, it's interesting because the thing that we put and that I posited before is a possible source was the fact of the laser induced plasma.
Right, exactly.
That was being used and tested. And we've got the patent up in our knowledge vault. Folks, you can stop on by and check that out. But it was approved February 6, 2020, filed in 2018. So, you know, back in 2014, it was being tested. The efficacy of it was being checked. And basically what this laser countermeasure does, here's the breakdown on screen for you folks. You can see the actual visual target. And this high-powered infrared beam creates a plasma in air, actively hyper-excites the air molecules where the laser is pointing, and creates a signature.
Mm-hmm. Infrared.
And if you look at the target, there's the infrared target signature. Oddly enough, looks almost exactly like what the Tic Tacs look like on the infrared. And if you notice, there has not been a single video released of them that is not infrared.
That's right.
That is not forward looking infrared.
They did have one that's called TV cam. One of those, they showed the object, and that was the FLIR 1 video, but we already figured out what that one is. So it's
The Batman balloon.
No, no, no. The FLIR 1 video is actually picked at. And they did turn it to camera mode, which means it was seeing it in IR and in the visual range too. So that one probably wouldn't apply. But even so, that what you're talking about, the technology that you're talking about now, they can even make that object do things, like if they wanted to split off or if they wanted to make it talk. I mean, they could excite the molecules to actually make noise, which could create an acoustic signature to sound like that plane.
Yeah. There it is right there. Electrostatic field. And if you've got an electrostatic field, you can make sound, whatever. Same as an electrostatic speaker.
Exactly.
No difference whatsoever. And if I'm not mistaken, these are actually visible. They turn into the realm of visible infrared because they actively burn so bright.
Exactly. And now they wouldn't show up if somebody's visualizing a hologram, it wouldn't do that. Although it's possible they could put a hologram on top of that same area and make it probably do all kinds of stuff. But so here you have a technology that can create an object and make it look real to an infrared. Can make it make the sound. So on an acoustic signature, it would make the similar sound to the object that they're trying to track or mimic. And then on top of that, you have it where it can be basically broadcast anywhere in the world, you know, within a reasonable distance from the laser. So, and that's technology that we know about, that we're hearing about.
Yeah.
So just like you and I love to think about and to postulate, whoa, what is it that we don't know? And like Clinton said, and when will we know it?
Right here. Section 0022. By rastering plasma, as mentioned in 130, it is possible to generate a 2D or 3D volumetric image in space.
Yep. Wow.
This is analogous to the rastering of an electron beam in a cathode ray tube based on television.
Yep.
Fully, this ghost image would appear to distract the homing missile away from the tangible air vehicle. In a second embodiment, there can be multiple laser systems mounted on the back of an air vehicle, with each laser system generating a, quote, ghost image, such that there would be, appear to be multiple air vehicles present.
Right. And so you can use that in a defensive or an offensive way. Defensive way, obviously you would create multiple objects or targets for incoming missile to go after. And then in an offensive way, you could produce all kinds of things to get them to turn their radars on by showing, oh, you got hundreds of these aircraft are heading towards us. We need to turn on our radar so we can track them and possibly shoot them down and then make them disappear. And then you're in. It's just amazing. And this is all, you know, it's like art of war kind of stuff. There's so many sayings that General Sal said that, you know, make your enemies think you're weak when you're strong and make them think you're weak and you're strong when you're weak, you know, all these different things. And that's this technology portrays that.
Here's an interesting part of this that it just dawned on me, might just be the source of the name of one of those videos. Alternatively, LIP, which is the technology they're talking about, could also be manipulated and distributed using a laser gimbal or turret that could be easily installed on an air vehicle, which could be anything from an aircraft, helicopter, ship, etc.
Mick would love that one.
I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. Like right there. Bam. Gimbal.
And the funny thing is just the term gimbal, it should have been a clue. The person that named that file named it. Why would he name it gimbal? I mean, who would come up with that name?
You know who would come up with that name?
Who?
Somebody who was archiving footage.
Yeah, they somehow knew what it actually was.
What the source of it was.
Yep. And that's like FLIR 1. Yeah. And it's like, that makes sense. Gimbal.
Camera 1, camera 2, you know, action cam, whatever, whenever you're archiving footage for a show or whenever,
except
you know.
Except for Go Fast. They mislabeled that one. They put Go Fast when it's actually, instead of it being low and fast, it was high and slow.
Go fairly average.
Yeah, exactly. Go average. Go medium speed or not ludicrous, you know, below ludicrous.
Yeah. Just below plaid.
Exactly. what an amazing
two
name, Burger.
Below Pelad. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, yeah, but that's just it. Like the existence of this technology is there, and you kind of have to know that arc of development, folks, and that concept of like the cooling range of technology, and the fact of the things that hit our shelf were available almost a decade ago to the military, were available mm-hmm. almost a decade ago to their contractors. So right. much like when we first heard about the F-17, it was flying a successful mission in Panama.
Yep.
You know, but before it went and made its big debut in the Gulf War, it made its actual debut taking down Manuel Noriega in part of the night raid.
That was his wake-up call.
And that's when we found out we had this stealth airplane that could do this that had been flying for 20 years. They've been testing this thing for 20 years, folks, like straight up on CNN said that this thing had been flying over our head for 20 years.
And it was amazing that they were able to keep that secret for that long, because that's not normally indicative of the military being able to keep a secret. And so this one, they did quite well.
Even contractors being able to keep that secret that long. And Skunk Works.
And then you got Lockheed Martin Skunk Works bringing out like the Manta looking thing that they had. You know, it's going to be a drone. And I remember when I was there, I can't remember if it's it's on it may be on the video that I have on my channel where I'm showing me at Skunk Works.
Mm-hmm.
And of course security was having fun with me. That was funny. So I filmed some stuff at Skunk Works, and when I did, I aimed the camera a certain direction, and that's when you see the security start moving around, and I'm like, oh God, I guess I aimed it the wrong way, but I zoomed in on it anyway. But it's just the parts for some new drones that were coming out. It's just amazing things that if we're seeing whatever we're seeing now, and of course we always contemplate, God, they've had this, they had that been in development for 5 to 10 years. What do they have now that we don't see? And that's where you kind of get some inside information when you just hang around some of these places, and people start, they don't necessarily talk like they're divulging secrets. Like a lot of people say, well, no one's going to tell you a secret bubble. Yeah, they kind of will. They kind of do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Feel free to listen close. You know, mm-hmm. and feel free to listen with a kind ear, folks.
Yeah, or buy them a couple of beers at the local VFW, and there you go.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, even here lately, there was the thing about like the satellite snapping an image of a top secret aircraft. I've got it up on screen right now. It's out of like the new the New Zealand Herald, I guarantee you that is not an image of the actual aircraft, folks. What you are looking at is like straight up printed on the surface of that canvas.
Oh, they made like an image to make it look like something.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the background of it, like you can clearly see right here where the sun is shining almost equally off of the plastic. Things like that. They don't, you know what you don't do? Hide things under clear Visqueen. Not even military, and this is no insult to you, but not even military contractors are that stupid.
Did they say what basis was this? Is that
Area
because
51.
Okay. Yeah,
Area 51. This is out of like the war zone wire, you know.
You may be looking at the baby image of the SR-72, because they made a smaller version of it.
Sure.
If it's triangular shaped with a noticeable hump all the way down the center line, is that what you're looking at?
Kind of like that. Sure.
Does that have a diamond shape?
It's definitely a delta. It's a delta shaped craft with a small bump for the exhaust. You know? Definitely matching the description that you're talking about. However. I guarantee you that this is not a clear tent over over the SR-72. Whatever it is printed on the top of that tent. You know, the same way that they would print like a micro camo pattern.
If it's the air tent that they move these things in, is it on a runway or is it on a road like leading up to a runway?
It's on a side road outside of a hangar.
Okay, yeah, that's the air tank. Okay, so yeah, that's a transport. That may actually be it, not a printed thing. That may actually be the aircraft.
Oh wow!
They move these. And here's the thing: it's let me think if I can say this or not.
But if you want to, I do not hinder free speech.
Okay, well, everybody's going to wonder the reason for the tent. Why would they have this over the clear tent or whatever? The air tent that's put over these things is because of the hypergolic fuels that this thing uses. So they still need to be able to see and whatever and do that. But why the top of this thing is clear? I always had that same question. This whole thing is like a boy in the bubble kind of thing. It kind of looks like a bubble tent, right? Like it's inflated
it looks like Visqueen.
Okay.
It looks like they're like getting ready to paint the inside of it.
It
looks like clear plastic, like what we're asked to like put over the floor of hotels to not to not jack up the floor with our cases, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's too funny that they actually, somebody snapped a picture of that. That's amazing.
It's funny because, I mean, I didn't even realize I'd seen it on the drive. I'd seen it other places. I posted it on the Curious Realm group, all that kind of stuff. But I didn't realize that the Warzone had picked it up.
And that gives it a little bit
different credence at that point, as far as, like you said, it possibly not being a printed distraction, you know, a known camouflage technique, so to speak.
Yeah, that's weird that they would do that. This is a daytime photo?
Oh, yeah. Like broad daylight.
Wow.
Like this is like few hours before golden hour, dude.
Wow. Like, yeah, because they roll it out in that. I've seen something similar to this, but they roll it out inside that air bubble thing, whatever you want to call it, the air tent, because of the hypergolic fuels and plus the shielded from dust and stuff. Because the instruments are so sensitive on the thing, they shield it from dust.
The extreme temperatures that they're dealing with out there, the sensors could go wild and just not operate to begin with if they're getting direct sunlight or something like that without airflow over them.
Yeah, so this tent structure actually they created it. They have a positive airflow, so it's just like when you walk into a hotel, you always feel the wind coming out. That creates a positive air pressure on the inside. So it has that, keeps dust off the unit. They don't have to worry about, you know, they can sit there on the pad waiting for as long as it wants. And they normally roll it out from the hangar, so normally it's like, you know, each one has its own bubble they can roll it out with. Wow, that's amazing, and that's actually shown. That's crazy.
Look it up.
Where's it at? On the, you said the New Zealand something?
This is nzherald.co.nz. You know, like
a member of Five Eye country, actually. And why New Zealand is a Five Eye country is kind of odd, but you know, a Five Eye country actually has a newspaper that printed a probably highly classified image. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it comes out of news.com.australia. It was released all over the place. All over the place. Wow. Really interesting. That was just a couple few days ago. I want to say maybe 2 or 3 days ago that wow. popped up.
So gotta catch up on that.
Yeah. I mean, really interesting. And the first thing I said whenever somebody responded, one of my friends in the group was like, "Oh, looks like that thing's painted on top." I was like, "Absolutely, looks like a traditional old school camouflage job." Yep. You know, like exactly what you would do to like make things look different from the air. You know, paint it to look like the ground and put like a helicopter with the blades put back.
Yeah,
you know,
it's like all the blow up. They had these tanks that were actually you can blow them up with an air gun. And then Russia had a whole bunch of missiles that they put out during their May Day parade or whatever. They were clearly made out of wood.
Yeah,
just to show that they had a lot more than that.
You could see the fins like moving and stuff while they were rolling down the road. It was pretty funny. But I mean, that kind of stuff has been done for God since World War One, World War Two, you know, least World War Two. I don't know. I guess camouflage got its start.
Probably before, in one form or another, it had to be, you know, pretty early on.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was World War One because that is when we started air campaigns. You know, that like literally lobbing grenades at a friggin' sup with camels. that kind of stuff. But to see the technology that's there, to see the stuff that that is possible from contractors at places like Area 51, where the budgets are without limit. Almost,
right.
Where the opportunity for research is without limit. It's pretty interesting to see some of the technology that comes out of that. And the whole premise that I have held from all of this disclosure, be it soft or whatever you want to call it, folks, is, the next realm of technology, the only way it will be explained is that it was reverse engineered at some point. That we found something, like whether it was given to us, whether we found it, whether it was shot down or crashed and we recovered it, whatever.
Did you see the interview on with Kurt Jamungle on Theories of Everything with Linda Mountain-Howe?
No, I didn't.
Oh my God! What a total meltdown, dude! You have got anyone listening to this that knows about Linda, and she's obviously an icon in the paranormal world and what have you, dating back to, you know, her the crop circles,
she's
cattle mutilation.
She's the original cattle mutilation.
Yes,
investigator.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So she there was a basic meltdown at the end of her interview with Kurt, and it was probably too late. They were shutting it down, and it went sideways fast, and it's something that you have to see. So yeah, definitely look at that.
I'm sure that's on her website, Earth Files.
Oh no, it won't be on her site. Oh. No, she had a meltdown. It was not pretty.
Meltdown.
She had the meltdown. Yeah, she sure did. Kurt asked her a couple of questions that she just went off on him. And the whole interview was awesome. I mean, she's a very well-spoken. She's an award. Yes. I mean, the girl's got Pulitzer Prizes and stuff like this. So she's an award-winning journalist who felt like her credibility was being attacked. And not that I would know anything about that happening, but she felt that. And she responded in kind. I sent Kurt a couple of questions to ask her about, you know, the metamaterials and did she have any other metamaterials? Because she sold that piece to Tom DeLonge for $33,000 to cover her expenses that she had for a while. And I was wondering, she had to have kept another piece. And sure enough, she did.
Yeah.
That's of the bismuth. So yeah, definitely watch that. I know here we are promoting some other channel, but that's a half to see.
No, I don't mind promoting other people's channels, especially whenever it's got content like that. I mean, Linda Moulton Howe is in my realm of dream guests.
Exactly.
Somebody that I want to interview because her work has been so vast in the field of paranormal research, in the field of UFOs, ufology.
Yeah, she just turned 80, and she is amazing. Number one, she's amazing looking for an 80-year-old woman. Absolutely, yeah.
And but on top of that, doing field work.
Oh my God, yeah! And her ability to recall dates and names and stuff was because I love doing that myself. But it's just phenomenal to see her do that. I was like, wow, she is absolutely amazing.
I recently watched, and it may have been part of that on Gaia. Because I remember her talking about the bismuth and everything else and them examining it. And man, yeah, I could watch Linda Moulton Howe all day. She's so fantastic.
But definitely watch that one. I think and it goes into more detail than I've seen her go into on several things. And Kurt's the guy that's been getting all these weird interviews lately of a person who, you know, he came out of the blue, and the next thing you know, he's got Lou Elizondo, he's got Linda Moulton Howe, he's got, you know, all these people that you would just, now we're trying to tell them to get Hal put off, you know?
Yeah.
That's like the Holy Grail, man. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's just it, though, to know that these people are in contact and working together. I think we have made some great strides, whether the disclosure is grand or soft. The important part is the disclosure.
Yep, that it happens.
And and that the technology be released, the things that we can do be known.
And then, like we said, the soft disclosure, the things that are leading up to what else could it be? Like the government hiring a bunch of priests to do what? To prepare us for, or to prepare the, what do you think?
Now that I've broached that topic with a couple people, with Jared Murphy, as well as with Daniel Allen Jones. I myself look at it as, and granted, the headlines were a little bit different with it. The what actually happened was they put money into a study about the social implications and ramifications of the finding of extraterrestrial life. And part of that study happened to be some Catholic priests.
Okay.
So that's what actually happened. It's not like they went like, "Hey, priest, you come here."
Oh wow! Because I was under the impression that was the
impression that all of the articles gave until you went through and actually read all of them, and found out that they gave money to a general study, and these priests were part of the study, and it makes sense that they're part of the study, especially Catholic priests. And here's why. If you want to talk to any religion in the world about how do you put across a unified message to all of your followers, Islam doesn't do that. Judaism fairly well does, but the problem is you've got a few branches of Judaism in there, and a lot of them don't follow what the others say.
Plus some don't have a clear, leader, so to speak. They don't have a hierarchy and structure of
however, the Catholic Church for 2000 years has pretty well maintained the fact of whenever they put a teaching out, this is what is taught by the churches. There may be a couple regional quirks here and there, but this is the overall teaching.
Right.
And to try to get a message like that out, and not only that, if you're going to talk about something that is going to change, this is going to change more than worldview, man. The point of fact that I keep talking about with people about it is that it is going to shake people's foundations. You can hypothesize and hearsay and conjecture about alien life and finding it and everything else until that thing pops out in front of you, or until they actively say, "Yes, here it is. Here are the possibilities."
Right. You have to wonder exactly how, it's one thing how the actual institution of the religious institutions, meaning the actual churches themselves, will respond to it, as opposed to, say, the parishioners that go to these institutions.
Exactly.
It might be two different things that may happen, because, one has a lot to lose and the other can just basically say,
the church came out almost a decade ago now. I want to say it was 2012 and said, any finding of life beyond our sphere does not interfere with the glory of God, does not interfere with God's creation.
Right.
It does not interfere with doctrine or dogma in any way, shape, or form. So no harm, no foul if we come across extraterrestrial life.
It's only the religions that actually push the thought that we are unique and we are special.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
That would have the issue. Other than that, most religions don't really get into that deep, into that philosophical belief we are it.
I would venture a guess, though, that even most people who are of, quote, spiritual belief, Mike, and those would be like the religious folk that go to church every Sunday, go to Bible study on Wednesday, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would venture a guess that even even a good 60-70% of them, their brain is not ready for the world rocking that it is. And I just yeah. say that as an experiencer of what I consider to be the touch of the divine at one point in my life.
One of the things that I read too, to go along with what you're saying, I read this and then I thought for a minute as to how could this be. The thought of mass commission of suicide.
Yeah.
Would be a realist, a something that is really going to be a problem. And I'm not a religious person at all. And so it was very difficult pill for me to swallow there as to why would this affect someone's, you know, individual beliefs or make them want to commit suicide. And once you read into it, I was like, oh, wow. Okay. It's starting to make a little sense. So it got really deep and really dark. Probably yeah, we man, don't want to go.
You're talking yeah. about the paradigm with which you have defined yourself no longer exists.
Yeah, exactly.
And when that exactly. happens, the
reason to live,
the world can come crashing down on you.
Right.
And it took me years to understand the wisdom of the small things that happened in the seminary that drove me nuts as a seminarian, and to see mm-hmm. the wisdom behind them. It took like a good 10 years down the road for me to go, oh, that's why they allowed that. Because if you mm-hmm. can't deal with it from the dude that you have like cereal with in the morning and go to morning prayer with and live across the hall from, how are you going right. to be in charge of that person that's doing that? Yeah. You know, how are you going to be the pastor at a church with 20 people like that working underneath you? You know,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. And there really is that tearing down and rebuilding up of you as a different person, and that mm-hmm. that purposeful, let's destroy what is there and rebuild it. And not everybody can handle that destruction part.
Yeah.
Not everybody handles that destruction part well. Same thing in the military. Not everybody handles the boot camp well.
No, or even the other factor is they may be able to handle the destruction part of it, but the rebuilding is going to be the bigger question. Rebuilding yeah. to what? What is that going to mean? I mean, it could be anywhere in between. So there's a lot of unanswered questions there
that's make it. That yeah, you are talking about an existential crisis of literally mm-hmm. biblical proportions, real wrath of God type stuff.
exactly.
But yeah, I mean, it's you're going to deal with a whole bunch of people that really just figured out that they are in a colony and that they're an ant. That's the equivalent, yeah. you know, yeah. and that's going to be a hard realization for a lot of folk. I'm not going to say it won't be a hard realization for me when it happens, but I definitely look at it as the fact of more a matter of time than a when or if.
I think the bigger another question is going to be is what will it change? I mean, the disclosure, does it mean that they've been visiting us, you know, blah blah blah? Now they're going to visit us openly, and we're just going to have to get used to it. Like we go to the bar, and it's going to be a scene like from the Star Wars cantina scene. Is that going to happen, or is this something that they're just going to say yes to other life exists? We have been contacted, but it's not like they're going to be coming here anytime soon.
Yeah.
You know, they're checking. Well, you know, who knows what it'll be.
Like I said, I my call is the fact of, yes, we have been visited. We have found things. We have recovered things. This is where some of our technology is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's going to be the only way you're going to be able to explain the next leap of technology. And the only way that you're going to be able to make money off of it is to be able to release it. And you're going to have right. to explain where the hell you got it from.
Yeah, it's going to circle out somewhere. Somebody's going to buy some military surplus yeah. at an auction somewhere and yeah. go, hey, what is this?
No, I mean, when you're talking about the sci-fi stuff that we're talking about, man, when you're talking yeah. about hypersonic missiles, when you're talking about the ways and means by which to track them and target them and take them out, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That is once again AI and technology on another level, folks. When yep. you're talking about metamaterials, the size of one slice of atom, that that are conducting electricity in new and amazing ways and giving us whole new possibilities. This is the stuff that has existed in dark labs for decades. This is the stuff that makes the HABBLUE program that F-17s and B-2s are born out of, that happened 15 years before those things were ever in the sky. In flying.
There's DARPA has a project that's called Open Catalog.
Yep.
And I haven't really done anything with it for actually a good while now. But that open catalog, just by the mere existence of an open catalog, the next thought is there a closed catalog? What do they do there? But the open catalog is cool because it's everything is almost open source. It's like you go in.
Yeah.
They have a project that they're working on, or they have a question that's brought up. It's called a DARPA hard, which is a technology that doesn't exist, and the technology to create the technology does not exist. So they have to create almost a whole new industry just to get the technology to a point where they can utilize it in what they brought up with to begin with. Like a think tank will come up with a solution to a problem, but the solution doesn't exist, nor the technology for the solution exists. And that's where it gets into some really, really deep thought processes there. It's just like you said, the plastic that's stronger than steel, right? It's four or five times stronger than steel. So where did the question and the need for that come from? Was it an accidental polymer that was, done in a lab, or did someone actually have an issue that they were tasked to create it? It's kind of interesting that when you start looking deeper into some of these things and you realize that A, the question was asked or it wasn't asked. If it's done by accident, that's where a lot of technology comes from. Rubber for tires and anything you can think of. But when it gets down to the question was asked, the deeper philosophical question is, why was the question asked for this technology to be created?
Yeah.
Was it nefarious in intent? Because most of the technology that we get that trickles down to us is generally coming from the military. Military applications. And so that makes a lot of people wonder, is our society ever going to grow out of this
industrial complex?
At some point in time, but we're so entrenched in it. If an alien came here, they'd say, look, you guys got a lot to figure out. We're going to come back in a couple thousand years. No, come back next month. It's my birthday. That kind of thing. And think about it from the outside. If you came here, you would see our people the way they are and what we do to each other and how we do this stuff. And it's just, it'd be like, they're not done yet. It's like the egg.
I know quite a bit about DARPA, but I had never realized until just now going through their About Us page that they literally came out of a military response to the launch of Sputnik.
Oh yeah, it was ARPA back in the beginning. It was ARPA.
Yeah.
But you're exactly correct. It was our responsibility because now we have a ball flying over our heads.
Yeah.
That's beeping, and they made it beep like that so that they could prove that they actually had put that object in orbit. Otherwise, there's nothing, no way to prove it. And so that was a wake up call, a huge wake up call. And so ARPA was created right after that. For just the purpose of going into new technologies to combat some of this stuff. But now it's more open. It's amazing when you go to some of these talks or some of their think tank things that they put out there and you sit back and they have a guest speaker come in and you're sitting at your table and you got this like 12 people at their table and y'all have these little cue cards in front of you. And so they mention, okay, here's a problem. We want you guys within 30 minutes or less to come up with a solution for this particular problem. And people come up with solutions in 30 minutes or less, bro. We're not talking about years.
Yeah.
We're talking about a bunch of people like, John McAfee was that one. That's actually where I met him. And you see this actually occur. Wow. It's like, okay, they should do this a lot across all bunch of industries.
Yeah. It's really phenomenal to see that stuff and to see the true think tank aspect of it. I was one step away. My last day of covering CES in Vegas, I was going to go interview DARPA. They were set up downstairs from us in the Sands Convention Center I guess now the Venetian Convention Center. But I was going to go down and interview him. And get this, folks, get this. The government contractors left early.
Did they really?
just saying. This was like numerous hours before the event was over. Like 4 hours before the thing was over, they were gone.
Wow, aren't you fine? I know they find you when you leave early. What is right?
I was like, I think they heard me saying I was coming. Because I brought my Curious Realm shirt and everything. I was going to be like standing at their booth doing a stand up interview talking about DARPA. It was going to be classy. So
you were at the Intelligence Summit last year, weren't you?
Yeah. I work a few events, things like that, every year.
Yeah, I remember it's
pretty
wild.
Pretty interesting, but yeah, Mike, just since you've been on, and that's why I love having you on sometimes and just talking about this stuff and just going over it, because there is such a swath of data out there regarding these cases. But if you don't know about the existing technology, if you don't know about Spy 1A, Spy 1B, A and Spy 1, if you weren't aware of the laser chaff system that came out, if you aren't aware of all these things, then
it's obviously extraterrestrial. If any sighting, if people don't know about some of the technologies,
of it being extraterrestrial is just, I don't know. I am a hardcore believer, Mike, to the bones that make my bones.
Right.
I'm a hardcore believer. But as always, and as Sagan would say, the extraordinary claim requires the extraordinary evidence.
Exactly.
And I am not willing to accept I am willing to accept the fact that like 20% and less are like, wow, what's that all about?
Yeah. Yeah, there's got to be a percentage of that. It's just like I questioned Chris Mellon the other day because he came out with this new post about, I don't know if you saw it on Twitter, because a lot of the stuff I post about is on Twitter right now. Mm. And so I went in and just started quizzing him on some questions that I had sent him before in emails back and forth that he's never answered. You know? And you're like, God, man, somebody has to know the answers to these questions. And and you know, my first tattoo was the Drake and Sagan disc that was put on the Pioneer Voyager spacecraft, stuff like this. And so I'm a believer too, but everyone thinks I'm, you don't believe, and you're just out here to tell us no.
I said no.
I do believe 100%, but I want to make certain that what I'm believing in, that if somebody tells me something, I want to make sure that it is what they're telling me that it is.
Yeah.
And that's all. That's my whole reason. I listen to this stuff. I love this stuff. And God, I want before I go to know that we are not alone for a fact. I want to shake the hand of a reptilian if I have to.
Sure.
Or Paul Gray or whoever, and be happy and die knowing that we're not alone. Okay. Click. Gone.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And you know, it's really the fact of making sure that what comes through is quality. That what's there is vetted, that what's there is questioned. Question is the important part. Being willing to question it, being willing to say maybe this is not the case, and being willing to go, hey, look, here's two or three different pieces of technology over the last many years that have been patented that
they could account for that.
May very well account for what you're seeing right now.
Yeah. And Salvatore Payas, by the way, he's going to be interviewed by Kurt Zsimongol, I believe, within the next week. So we're going to get to see. Yeah, I sent Kurt some questions there, about the patents that he put out that were from the Navy that, you know, make everyone's head turn. If any one of these patents hold out to be true, any just one of them, it's an instant Nobel Prize for this guy. This guy should have like five Nobel Prizes by now. Some of the stuff, the technology boggles the mind, but at the same time, you start seeing this logical progression that we're going in. And have we received something that's like you alluded to earlier. Did we receive some technology from advanced civilization from somewhere else that's helping us along?
Yeah, find it, recover it, whatever, sure. But is what we are seeing in the sky and on these tapes, all three videos that we have, is it extraterrestrial in source and origin? I am a 78% no.
I'm 99.9%, and it's just because I've delved into it so much. You know, FLIR 1 is that video, and everybody complains to stories, but that's a video, in my opinion, of the F-18 at a distance. Yeah. And I talked to the pilot of that F-18 that it may be of, and he was a NASA pilot that flies an F-18. Because we had all the other F-18s were accounted for, but this particular one wasn't. So, okay.
Well, and there it is. And once again, going through and looking at the photos from that, from the FOD laser countermeasures, whenever you look at the image that is produced, go back and look at the images. Go back and look at the images, folks. Like, that is what they look like.
Yeah. Right. And on my channel, I've got a comparison of an F-18 flying out and doing a slow banking turn to the left and the Tic Tac, and it's almost identical, except for, you know, one's further than the other. But if you take a look at that, you'll see it's only a 20-second video. It's not that long.
Yeah.
But it's a, you know, it's a comparison. It's and David Fouch, who does FLIR work, but not at FLIR, but he works on FLIR, produced that video to show that it was not a F-18 or what have you. And then I put the two side by side, man, if they don't look the same, I need to get a different profession. But, I want the answer so bad. I just don't want to push the answer envelope. We want to have accurate information, and our government is obviously withholding enough of it, almost like we're puppets on a string to them. Like they're laughing at us. They're having fun. It's like, okay, let's not fully admit this, but let's word it this way. And so they word it in such a way that the UFOs seen in these videos are real. And of course, what happened after that? A huge group of people come out and say, oh, there's the proof now that these UFOs are alien in existence. That's where they come from.
No.
That's not what it said.
No, it said that they are an actual thing. Like, what you're seeing is not a trick of camera.
Right.
It's not made in Adobe After Effects.
Right.
It's not made in, like, Unreal Engine. This is real, actual video. From a forward-looking camera pod.
Yeah, and it's exactly as they saw it back then, except for the video, obviously, is degraded quite a bit.
Well,
yeah, they're trying to tell me
that. I qualify all the time that, yes, I have seen a UFO. No, I have not seen a flying saucer.
Right, there you go.
I have not seen what I believe to be an alien craft. Have I seen a huge object amorphously traveling through the sky with other people with me? Yes. Genuine bona fide UFO, unidentified flying object.
I did see a flying saucer.
Just because you ticked saucer. Off your girlfriend and she threw a saucer at you.
You saw where I was going with that. My first wife threw a saucer at me, and I just remembered that. I said, I saw a flying saucer.
I didn't get this glass eye from nothing.
Taken right off the bottom of her coffee and flew across the room. I was like, what the hell is this all about?
Right. Wung it right at me. But, Mike, I want to thank you for always coming on, man. Always being so candid the information. Always the knowledge bombs that you drop and the rabbit holes that we travel down are always so great. So much fun.
They
I want to thank
fun.
You for and for always just standing in. You and Dr. John Hall, who you were actively standing in for. He was booked to be on here and then ended up coming down with an illness from his daughter that apparently he not chicken pox or anything, but he never had it as a kid, so it's like busy putting the whip down on him right now.
Hopefully he springs out of that pretty fast and then comes back.
Vibes of healing to the good doctor out there. And don't worry, folks, we will. But as soon as his voice is like usable, believe me, he'll be on the show. But you and Dr. John Hall have done so much for this show in so many ways. And a lot of that is literally just being like you were yesterday when I was like, hey, man, had a guest drop out. You available for a pre-record segment tomorrow? Yeah.
And I instantly replied, sure.
Yeah.
not even a second went by. I was like, sure.
And that's just it. So,
thank you, buddy.
Well, let everybody know where they can go to subscribe, follow, where they can go to come join the conversation, all that good stuff.
Right now, my primary outlet, which has been waxed a little bit because of the Afghanistan situation where I haven't been able to produce videos as often as I wanted to, but 5x5 News on YouTube. You can also catch me on Twitter, which is where I have multiple conversations going on with a lot of groups of people. So either on Twitter at 5x5 News or on YouTube, 5x5 News. That's all you got to remember, and I appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And of course, folks, while you're up, please do hold the line while we sign off everything else here, Mike. While you're online checking all that out, you can also, of course, stop on by and subscribe to Mike's YouTube channel and everything else directly on our CuriousRealm.com/videos page. Stop on by, check that out. You can see videos from all of our guests, including Mike Turber and 5x5 News. You can subscribe to them all right there. Stop on by CuriousRealm.com/store. Stop on by Facebook. Join the conversation in the Curious Realm group. That is where we have all kinds of conversations about these topics. It's where we draw the articles for the news of the week. All that good stuff. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.